to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today we have a special broadcast. It's at a different time, as you probably noticed. That's to accommodate two wonderful actors, Biko Elston Martin and Bowen Wright, who are performing in Marin Theater Company's production of Susan Laurie Park's Top Dog Underdog, and it's been extended to the 28th of this month. We are listening to some of the original score produced by Chris Houston for the company. And I'm going to let you listen to the rest of this, and then I'll read you the bios for the two actors. Hopefully they'll be joining us in the studio shortly. However, our guest did not arrive. Oh, my goodness. We have a really great show planned. We're going to have an interview with Pete Nix, who is the director of The Waiting Room, which is having its Bay Area premiere at the Grand Lake Theater on Friday, I believe 7 o'clock. It's an ITVS collaboration with some other folks, and that's a wonderful film about Highland General Hospital, the waiting room there, and emergency medical services, and the people that are clients and also the people that deliver services. This is a great film. We had a wonderful conversation last week. That film won all kind of awards, the Golden Gate Award at San Francisco International Film Festival. You might have caught it there. It's going to be on ITVS next year, I believe in January, or it's a part of that season. So that's a really wonderful interview. And then, if I can get it together, I had a wonderful interview with the Museum of the African Diaspora's director, Grace C. Stanislaus, about the current exhibit at MOAD, Desert Jewels, North African Jewelry and Photography from the Xavier Durand Hermes Collection. And it's open, the exhibit opened this month, and it's going to be on view through January, like January 21st, which is awesome. And we're going to, between that interview with Grace, if I can get it together, like that is play it, we're going to have director Charles Burnett in the studio, and he's going to be talking about one of his films, which is a part of L.A. Rebellion, continuing through this month at the Pacific Film Archive, which is located in Berkeley, at UC Berkeley, and his film we're going to be talking about, among other things, because you know, he's just simply fantastic, is, I'm trying to think, where is it? Uh-oh, don't see it. You probably already saw My Brother's Wedding. That's one of his films as well. But the film that we're going to be seeing is one of his shorts. It's called When It Rains. And Billy Woodbury, who we had an interview with last week and broadcast it last Thursday, he's in the film. So a lot of other folks are. So that's real exciting. So, well, while we wait for the actors to join us, I'm going to play something something else, and then be back with you in a second. Not a second, literally, but a little bit. I'm going to play I'm going to play The Pyramids, which have a show coming up, a wonderful reunion show, and that's going to be at the African American Art and Culture Complex, the Barrio Say Clay Theater in San Francisco. I believe it opens November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's a Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It's going to really be exciting. And we had an interview with them as well. I might actually have some tickets to give away, they told me. They might let me do something like that. So it's like, ooh, cool. So I'm going to play their Otherworldly, because the world of Top Dog Underdog, even though you think you know it, oh my goodness, it is certainly otherworldly. Top Dog Underdog, and we're hope the Biko and the other actor Bowman will be able to join us. It's kind of interesting, Biko and Bowman. They're brothers, and they got similar names too. Isn't that kind of cool? I mean, they're brothers in the play, but they've got similar names. This particular play by Susan Laurie Parks actually got the Pulitzer Prize, which is really exciting. And the play is about two brothers. And the two brothers, their names are Lincoln and Booth, which is kind of interesting. The father tells one of the brothers, the elder brother, Lincoln, that he named them Lincoln and Booth, the president and the man who killed him, as a joke. Ha ha, right. And this particular piece is about two brothers, and they live together. And Lincoln, actually, his job is he plays the president in whiteface because he's a black man, and people as you know come into the arcade and they shoot him. Yeah, sort of like you know that's he's one of the amusements. And meanwhile, oh, I think one of our guests are joining us. Let's see, which one is it? Is it Biko or is it Bowman? Let's see. Good afternoon. Is this Biko or Bowman? Hello?
Biko.
Biko.
This
oh,
is Biko.
Yeah. Glad you could join us. I'm just talking to myself. Well, I mean, there are people listening, but you know.
Yeah.
And I was just, when I was reading your bio, preparing, I was like, oh, I saw him in the play over at, the intersection for the arts.
Fuku.
Fuku, yeah, you were excellent. That was a really good play. I was wondering how they were going to, you know, sort of transform that really wonderful novel into a stage production, and you all really pulled it off well.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Excellent. Just as your character, gosh, Boop, he is amazing. And I'm going to read your bio. You're making your Marin Theater Company debut with Top Dog Underdog, and you're originally from San Francisco. And you have appeared in Bay Area and Fuku Americanas, which you were talking about, at Intersection for the Arts, Radio Golf at Theater Works, and I saw you in that because I saw Radio Golf. Who was your character in Radio Golf?
I was an understudy in that.
I just saw your picture in the program. I didn't see you on stage.
Understudy in Peter Callender and Aldo Billingsley in that.
Oh, okay, yeah, I guess they never got sick.
Yeah, man. They were supposed to fake one for me, but they never got around to it. Pros don't get sick, I guess.
Right, yeah. Hi, Bowman, how are you?
I'm fine.
Glad you could join us. I'm reading Biko's bio.
Hello?
Yeah, I think you said hi.
Oh, okay, what's up, man?
How you doing, brother?
I'm living it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're kind of low, Bowman. Can you say something else? We can't hear you really well. Oh, that's much better.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, you can pull out your guitar and sing something for us like you do in the play. That was really nice.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so,
you know, come to serenade us, Bowman.
Yeah, so Biko, you also in Susan Laurie Park's 365 play, 365 Days at Z-Space, so I saw you in that. Patricide Revisited at San Francisco Theater Fest, Clockwork Orange at Renegade Theater, All Guys Chillin' Got Wings at the Eugene O'Neill Festival, and you've been a whole lot of plays, To Kill a Mockingbird, Christmas Carol, Tame of the Shrew, and others at Denver Center for Theater. Denver Center Theater Company, King Lear, Our Town, Tame of the Shrew at Colorado Shakespeare Festival, and so on and so on. People should read the bio in the program when they go see you at Marin Theater Company. I'm so happy you all have, the play has been extended through the 28th. That is excellent because you all are so good.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I couldn't get up out of my seat after it ended. I'm like, I thought I remembered the play, but I didn't remember it the way you all do it. I'm like, ooh. I mean, really socked me into my heart, man. It's like, it was just so, so sad. So wrenching. So, Biko, you have also appeared in the film Poetic License, Aizen Martin, and you're a graduate of the National Theater Company with the MFA and Brown University, a BA and an MAT. What's the MAT stand for?
It's a master's in teaching.
Oh, okay, yeah, because you taught in San Francisco, right?
No, I taught at Berkeley High, yeah.
Right, yeah. But how long ago was that you taught at Berkeley High?
That was a few years back, about 3 or 4 years ago was my last year there.
Yeah, did you teach theater arts or English or what?
No, I taught history, actually. History.
Oh, that's perfect. Okay, yeah. And then Bowman Wright, you play Lincoln, and you're making your debut too. Well, what a way to come in with a bang, both of you. Wow. Yeah, and Bowman, you were last seen in A Raisin in the Sun at the was it Jeva Theater Center in Rochester, New York, and your other theater credits include A Midsummer Night's Dream at La Jolla Playhouse, The Dreamer Examines His Pillow. That sounds interesting. At Shakespeare and Company in Massachusetts, the piano lesson at Virginia Stage Company, Since Africa, and A House with No Walls at Interact Theater Company in Philadelphia, and Fences at Actors Theater in Louisville. And you're a graduate of the University of California, San Diego with an MFA and the University of the Arts with a Bachelor's in Fine Arts. Where's the University of the Arts? I don't know that one.
That's in Philadelphia.
Okay, is that where you're from?
No, I'm actually from Newark, New Jersey.
Oh, from New Jersey. Okay, Newark. Wow, okay, so that's a Mary Baraka town.
Yeah,
I used to live right around the corner from him.
Okay, yeah. Were you neighbors? I mean, like neighborly? Like you know him?
No, man. I've seen him a few times, and I got friends that know him personally. I never really went to his poetry things. I've always just read his stuff.
Okay, nice. Yeah. So tell us about, the synergy between these two brothers and sort of what brought you to this play. And Biko, how did you happen to be cast as Booth? And Bowman, how did you happen to be cast as Lincoln? And look at this alliteration thing happening, Biko, Bowman, Booth. I mean, like, whoa, what's happening here?
I don't know too much about the alliteration, but, I just auditioned. I auditioned everybody else did, and I was fortunate enough to get the role. And, so we just, went to work as soon as we knew, that we were going to be in it, started studying up. And then, we get together about 3-4 weeks before the show and, start rehearsal. And then we really go to work. And then, you see the play that, and the play is still evolving. I think we're still developing, as characters, as brothers, as storytellers in this. It's such a complex story. It's really no limit, I think, to how far, you can take it, and how well you can understand it and how, natural you can be in the acting of it, Just a lot. There's so much material there,
Yeah, your character, though, he's the kid brother. He's the younger brother, and he's kind of nostalgic in his memories. His brother Lincoln is the one that sort of raised him, so to speak, when both parents left, one after another, and left them each with inheritance. It was like, whoa, this is interesting. And your character is Booth. He's got this innocence, but then also, he's really, like, if you mess with him, he's gonna knock you. He's gonna like hurt you seriously, cause he really likes guns.
He
always has one. He's like arming himself, but it seems like the armor is a more spiritual as well as, safety kind of armament because he's been hurt, so he feels, I think, that he has to like wear this protection all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, we use the kind of metaphor of being kind of caged in a lot. It's just us two in this small room, and you think about two lions in a cage. But the cat we usually refer to more is the panther, because the panther is more defensive animal,
Okay.
And it manifests a little bit differently in the animal kingdom than in the, in the human world. But, I think we're both very much guarded, because of the way we've been hurt, and we guard ourselves differently, And my protection is literally, my peace, that's something to keep, me safe, But I think it's also, my nostalgia is also, I think, part of my armor, as I kind of have these memories that I cling to, and the memories kind of turn into fantasies, and the fantasies, then I try to make them my reality. Mm-hmm. And when that reality doesn't click, hell breaks out,
Right, yeah. But your character, he's really skillful with regards to, theft. I mean, he is he's really good at that, good at it. And so he has like a non-traditional kind of way of sort of acquiring things. Whereas Roman, your character,
No, I think his theft, you know, his ability to steal, it comes from his abandonment issues, you know, because I think he has really stuck in his head that he's invisible, you know, and that nobody sees him, you know, so, and I think that helps him to go in and do what he has to do to steal, you know, it's very much a part of his makeup, so to speak, you know.
Yeah. Interesting. And then Bowman, you know, your character Lincoln, he's the big brother. He's the one that is the nurturing character. He's got the day job. You know, he was married, even if he's not married now. And I don't know why he puts up sleeping in his chair. Like, why does he put up with that?
Well, you know, it's not his house. It's not his home. Although he takes care of his little brother, it's not his. I mean, also too, you know. Hello?
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of noisy stuff happening.
Lincoln, he is, in some way, he, you know, to put himself in that chair, it's not, I don't think it's as bad as it may seem that it may be to you as an audience member. To me, it's a tactic. It's him putting himself in a situation where he can be just him. And I think he puts himself through a certain kind of a punishment because he's trying to forgive himself for things that he feels that he has done in the past that he needs to reconcile. But also he is denying himself of himself in a large part of the play. And I feel like and that's part of it, you know, denying his own comfort to a certain degree. Even though it's something as small as is sleeping on a chair, it also manifests as what he does to himself when he leaves the house, when he goes around people, and how he presents himself and how he tries to. It's funny because to a large part of the play, there's one character in the play that is trying to feel like he's not invisible, and it's the other one that's trying to be invisible just for a little while.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know. And that's what I think about. That's what I think about Lincoln in some way. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Lincoln is really interesting. I want you to talk about, both of you can talk about this, because, you know, I mentioned before you all came to the studio that your character Lincoln plays Lincoln in Whiteface, and when he comes home to your home, Biko, you know, Booth's home. In costume, the first time, Booth pulls a gun on him. I'm like, whoa. Yeah, like Booth for real shot Lincoln. And so what is this, a foreshadowing or what? And then meanwhile, the stage is set with all of these sort of electoral colors, and we got like the red, white, and blue, and the stars, and all that stuff happening. And your character, Bowman, says some really wonderful things around the character about you know, why he likes that role, Lincoln, because he's, you know, he talks about, you know, sort of being invisible and being in that space, and he talks to his brother about how hard it is to convince, you know, a patron that this black man is really this white president.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think that he's talking, when he says that speech, I don't necessarily think it's, when I say that speech, I don't necessarily think it's about what people perceive him. And I don't think he cares if they get that he's the president or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's saying it's hard for him to even do it.
Right.
It's hard
yeah.
for him to sit there and be this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he makes it work.
Right.
You know, he makes it something that's doable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not necessarily about him to making people believe that he's Lincoln. He knows he can't do that. I mean, the white face is not even white face. It's white face.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like a Caucasian at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I don't think that's the game that he's playing. I mean, And I mean, Biko had to practice the whole shoot me in the head thing before. And I tell you, it's one of the hardest things for me to accept that somebody's always behind me, that somebody's about to shoot me in the head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it's fake. You know what I mean? It still doesn't register to me as something normal. And I'm acting it. I'm not actually going. I mean, it's the same thing Lincoln was doing. He's acting. I'm acting it, not necessarily getting shot in the head, but it's still somebody behind you like that. Sometimes it's real.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I was wondering if you all could talk about some of the symbolism, because, you know, we've got this inheritance. We've got these two brothers, and you say it's like the apartment is like a cage, and they have a partition that Booth brings in to sort of give himself a little privacy, and then Booth has this relationship that is more fantasy than reality, and then we have, you know, these cards. You know, he's practicing. What's the card game called?
Three card.
Yeah, yeah. And so what does all this represent? And then the question that I believe Lincoln asked, you know, why did they leave us? I think. Is that your character that asked that question?
Lincoln asked
that question.
Yeah,
I mean, we talk about four things in the play, right? We talk about our parents, we talk about Link's job, we talk about throwing the cards, and we talk about the women that we love, you know. And I think those things that, you know, we kind of touch on them differently depending on our moods, you know, and depending on what else is going on in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the symbolism, I think, I mean, that's partially for people to come in, you know, see for themselves, you know, and why are these brothers playing this game of chance? Why is that their game? Why is that their hustle? What is it about, you know, these characters that make, why is he such a good thief? Why is he such a good hustler?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is these things that their parents left them and these lessons that their parents gave them or didn't give them, why is it so important to them? Why does it kind of haunt them and dominate their life? You know, I mean, those, they're bigger open-ended questions that I think people kind of just have to come and see and make their own decisions about. You know, I mean, I could talk for hours about how I feel about, you know, what our parents gave us. But the fact of the matter is they, you know, when it comes down to it, they gave us a little, you know, and it weighs on us a lot. You know what I mean? And it, the conflicts that creates is what creates the drama. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you look at the cards and you've got like the red heart and you've got the black spades, and in one scenario when I think when Booth is practicing, the black card loses, and then when Lincoln is practicing, the black card wins. And so yeah, it's,
I mean, I think that's just a minor. Different brothers use different colors. I don't think there's like a deep significance behind that.
I think that's just
to show, you know, how we're trying to, you know, be different, you know, or I'm trying to be different than him. I'm trying to take it somewhere else, you know, to be my own man as opposed to just following Link, even though that's pretty much what I'm doomed and destined to do regardless.
Yeah, but then, you know, but then when your character, Lincoln, you know, he's sort of abstaining from playing cards, and Booth is saying, you know, why don't you do what you used to do, because you were so good at it, and we could, like, just clean up and, you know, and just bring in a whole lot of money and be able to do a whole lot better, and Lincoln's, like, sort of really resistant. So what's the backstory on that? Why is Lincoln sort of holding back and almost like he's doing repentance? What happened to the wife?
Well, it's not necessarily about the wife. You know, it's about signs. You know, Lincoln got signs that something wasn't going to go right, so he saved his own life. he first, you know, first he got up and he felt that something was wrong. Something wasn't right. I don't feel like it no more. I don't have a taste for it no more, but I still want to go do it. So he goes out and do it. The next sign was his best friend got shot. And then the third sign comes in, and he says to himself, he died. Lonnie died. Maybe I need to take a step back. And his wife left him. And then all these different things happened. And then, you know, I totally agree with what Biko just said. It says you have to really come in and take from it what you get from it. Because I can tell you a whole bunch of different reasons of why Lincoln decides not to throw the car. But it's really up to, you know, what I put out there is what the audience get is what they're going to get. But my story is I still hang about it being redemption, being careful, him recognizing that there's something bigger out there that he's trying to reach, but he needs time. He just needs time away. He needs time to just really collect his thoughts and really figure out what exactly he wants to do. And it's that whole struggle of trying to do what society says you should do, and then trying to also do what you in your heart, what you think you should be doing. So you really have to. I'm one of those people, you know, Biko will tell you, I'm one of those people that I try not to tell people what to think or how to feel about anything that I do, but mostly to come in and take out what you get from it, because that's more important to me than me trying to dictate how you feel about something or how you see something.
Well, I was thinking about the intention behind the, you know, the character, sort of what you're thinking behind the creation of this character. So I know you all go out into the community and talk to young people, and even I don't know if you've done it already, but I know you have you've actually performed the play in the community, you know, with the community around and young people in particular. And so I was wondering, sort of, when you think about this story, I saw this story as a story that that's taking place right now. In a lot of families, there are a lot of relationships that these two young people, these two brothers, reflect. And I was wondering, what do you tell people? What do you tell the youth? What do you tell your audiences when you're sort of preparing them for what they're going to see, or in the talkback? Sort of, what's been some of the feedback you've gotten from folks about the two brothers, Booth and Lincoln?
You know what? I think the show can be much more important, not only for the kids to see, but also for the parents to see. The idea of abandonment, we I know Biko already touched on it, but what it actually does to the next generation. And thankful that this is small, but not small, but I really think it's a huge thing, how less and less education is less and less important in today's society. What I mean by that is, you know, you'll have people go to college for one thing, and they'll study that one thing, but they don't want, they will not, it's not encouraged for them to broaden their mind, but only to tunnel vision of their thought. But what this play says is that we can't abandon anything in our surroundings, anything that's part of our upbringing, because it helps us become the people that we would love to see in the world. It helps us become the strong people. It helps us become people that are grounded, people that know how to do things without having hurt someone else in the process. This play, you see two brothers who've been abandoned at a young age, who haven't been taught a proper upbringing, who hasn't been around proper people to bring them up, because those people wasn't brought up the right way either. They turn into doing things that are not necessarily that is criminal. That's not necessarily what we would call good people. So I just I just think this play is a good play because it teaches us the importance of being there for each other. There's some part in that play that tells us that we as a community, we as parents, we as brothers and sisters, we have to learn how to be there for each other to help so we all can have a proper upbringing. It's a community play in a lot of different ways. So if I would tell a student, is just to be there for you, be there for each other. You know, you see somebody doing something wrong, you know, you tell them about yourself, especially, you know, with somebody in your family or your friends. It's not being afraid to do what, I mean, it could, you know, Lincoln could have said to his brother a bunch of times, man, look, man, you don't really need to steal. You know, we could find another way of doing this. You know, me and you, you know. Or he can say, listen, well, this is a card deal, and this is how we're going to do it, and this is why we need to do it this way. But that never happens, you know,
right.
Because they never was taught to really, they've never really been taught by their parents to be there for each other. They were forced to be there for each other. And that's the thing that, anyway, that's just my overall thing on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Biko?
Yeah.
Some concluding thoughts about one of those themes that you mentioned at the plays about we just talked about abandonment, talk about you know, sort of this inheritance. I just think that's one thing that your character talks about a lot, the inheritance, and then his, your character's pride and his feelings, you know, his feelings get hurt. I think Lincoln hurts his feelings by laughing at him and around cheapening, you know, the fact that he's held on to this inheritance just on the faith that it's, you know, came from his mother and he, you know, he values it for that without even, you know, checking to see if it is what she says it is when she leaves it to him. And then
all the story away.
Right, true. And then also you think about in your character, in both characters, it's sort of like, you know, the destiny. It's like almost like inheritance in a destiny that one is inheriting without thinking about where one's behavior, the root causes or the roots of one's behavior. So talk about, you know, your inheritance, your character's inheritance. Or you can maybe talk about one of your favorite scenes.
I mean, yeah, in terms of the inheritance, I mean, I think it's just what you said. You know, it's the last thing his mother gave him. So it's extremely, you know, precious to him. You know, it's a invaluable, priceless object, you know, that he intends on keeping his whole life. In terms of my favorite scene, you know, every scene is so different. It's hard to really say which one is my favorite. You know, different scenes are, you know, they kind of each have their fun moment and they each have their dark moment. You know, and I hate saying that, dark moment. They're sad moments. You know, so it's different, and some, you know, it's different every night. You know, some nights certain scenes pop, you know, more than they did the night before, and certain, you know, it's such a fluent process. And like I said, there's so much that, you know, we're constantly growing with it. So it's hard to say which scene is my favorite scene, you know, but it's definitely one of my favorite plays that I've ever been in. And I think that's probably more important than just, you know, my favorite scene, because, again, they're all so different. And the vibe of each is different, you know. And there's, you know, but, I love the clothes when I come in with the clothes and having fun with my brother when we get to have our new clothes and, I mean, little stuff like that, but, you know, again, I want people to come see the show and, you know, they can tell us what their favorite scene is, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I like Yeah, I think the costuming is really fantastic. You all look really nice, particularly when you you know, when you're like all dressed up for, you know, a date or something like that. Suit, you look really, really good. And then yeah, I like it when you're being like really intimate. You know, the two of you are just sort of having a great evening at home, and you have, is it the medicine? Is that what you call it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We call whiskey the medicine.
Right. Those moments are really nice too. Particularly as I mentioned earlier, Bowman, when Lincoln pulls out in the guitar and just you know, sort of goes there for us, you know, musically with the blues, real nice. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today on the show. And congratulations on an extended run. That's always wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm going to try to get back because, like I said, it was just really fantastic. I just really enjoyed it quite a bit. Yeah, yeah, really, really wonderful production of this classic, this young classic that Susan Laurie Parks has written, Top Dog Underdog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All righty. Well, you both take good care, and thank you again.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right.
So the Marin Theater Company's production of Top Dog Underdog is extended again through the 28th. And for information, you can visit the website marintheatercompany.org or call the box office at 415-388-5208, 415-388-5208 for exact performance times and dates. And gosh, we are going to play the interview with the director of The Waiting Room, and that is Pete Nix. And I was looking for the bio so I could tell you more about him. However, I can't find it fast enough. So let me see if I can locate it really quickly. And I'm going to play another piece from Top Dog Underdog because they've got some more beats, some more beats which are not as long as the first section that I think are pretty cool. Yeah, the original musical score is really nice. And so, and again, that's Chris Houston. So we're going to play what he describes as Beat 6. Top Dog Underdog, and that play is directed by really wonderful direction. Wasn't able to get the director on, but it was directed by Timothy Douglas. Wonderful, wonderful vision. And again, sound design is fabulous, costumes are fabulous, and the lighting and set design, really provocative. Pete Nix is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker who has produced projects for network, cable, and public television exploring topics such as immigration, journalism, and technology. Additionally, he has directed media strategy for two social networking startups and developed transmedia storytelling projects that make use of emerging social media platforms. He worked as a staff producer for ABC News in New York and as a producer for the innovative PBS documentary series Life 360. Nix earned his master's in documentary filmmaking from the University of California, Berkeley in 1999, and he's the director, as I mentioned, of this award-winning film that's having his Bay Area debut October 19th at Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, Sundance Kabuki in San Francisco, and Camera 3 in San Jose. But the only place that he's going to be in town is in Oakland, so which makes sense because Highland General Hospital is in Oakland. And so the film is called The Waiting Room, and it talks about Highland Hospital, Oakland's Highland Hospital, and it's the primary care facility for over 250,000 patients of nearly every nationality, race, and religion, with 250 patients, most of them uninsured, crowding its emergency room every day. Using a blend of cinema verite and character voiceover, The Waiting Room offers a raw, intimate, and often uplifting look at how patients, staff, and caregivers cope with disease, bureaucracy, frustration, hope, and hard choices during one typically hectic day. Weaving together several stories ranging from a frightened child with a dangerous case of strep throat, a young man with a testicular tumor in dire need of surgery, as well as those suffering from chronic conditions such as alcohol and drug abuse, heart disease, and diabetes. The Waiting Room lays bare the struggle and determination of both a community and an institution functioning with limited resources and no roadmap for navigating a healthcare landscape marked by economic and political dysfunction. Through this story of one hospital and its multifaceted community, the film powerfully and poignantly illustrates the common vulnerability to illness that binds us together as humans. And Pete Nix and I had a wonderful interview last week, and so I'm going to play you a pre-recorded interview with him where we talk about this film and it's, you know, how he made it and the team that worked with him. It's really, really wonderful, as I mentioned earlier, and really great. It's going to also be as a part of ITVS. And I'm like, you know how it is when you're searching for things, you look so hard. So here we are, Pete Nix, director of The Waiting Room. I think you have given us a great service by making The Waiting Room.
Thank you.
I think it's more eloquent than any politician, anyone could ever say, because you can't misinterpret it at all.
Right.
Because you're letting the people that are affected speak for themselves, and it's really a shame what's happening in this waiting room, which is like a metaphor. I mean, it's a great, great title.
Mm-hmm. That was why we chose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was just, you know, just really moved by all of these fabulous stories, and I just love the caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. I mean, Highland Hospital, I used to live right across the street from Highland Hospital, 14th Avenue, and for about 3 years. And my father was a patient in Highland Hospital, and he had renal failure. So I'm really familiar with the county hospital. And I remember when they built the new facility, and, I mean, they're really good with critical care. But as Dr. Douglas White was saying, and other doctors, they're not, they don't take the place of a primary care physician.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, your wife, she works there at Highland Hospital, so you were familiar with it as well. And then in, was it 2010, you decided to make this film?
Yeah, I mean, the a little bit of a long and winding story how the film came to be, but there were two projects. There was a project that Bill Hirsch and Scott Burgess got started in 2007 that was, you know, going to be sort of ostensibly a film about the uninsured, told from Highland Hospital. And I had been wanting to make this film for years because my wife worked there, and her first job out of grad school was at Highland, and I had just finished film school, and she would come home with stories about the patient population, and sort of, and it immediately struck me that it would be a great place to tell a story about a community and sort of their relationship to an institution. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the years went by, and, you know, I heard about this other film that was being made in 2007. She came home and told me that this documentary crew was about to make a film, and I happened to know the filmmakers, Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman. And so I approached them. I knew Jeffrey, and I approached those guys, and they hired me onto the project. And then, for a variety of complicated reasons, that project, the funding never totally came through for the project, and it sort of went into hiatus. But I couldn't get out of my head, and so I approached everyone, these sort of the original investors, Bill and Scott, and Rob and Jeffrey, and the folks at the hospital. I told them I wanted to take over the project, and that I would raise the money myself. And that was in 2009, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you secure so much access? I mean, you were there from sun up to sundown and sunrise again, and you were like in the room where the ambulance would bring in those people that, you know, were in crisis, and you were, you know, you didn't show us their faces, of course,
yeah.
But we know we saw the resuscitation, you know, process for a 15-year-old who had been shot, and you were like right there when, you know, the nurses, nurse assistant Cynthia Johnson was giving pep talks and scolding people that didn't know how to treat their elders. And she was phenomenal. Gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are some great stories that we're able to allow, I mean, the people allowed us to hear. I mean, the poor man, Davido Lushan, who was in so much pain, but he had to keep on working.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and he made too much money to afford medical, you know, assistance, you know, for people that don't have money. He had too much money.
Well, he made too much to qualify for the charity care, and that's a part of sort of the process of, you know, a safety net hospital that, you know, we thought a lot of people probably did not understand, is that, you know, you go into a public hospital and you don't necessarily walk out of there without a bill, and so he was one of those types of characters that we wanted to put in the film to articulate, you know, to break some of the misconceptions that we thought people might have about public hospitals. And, you know, the access was really a function of the vision of the CEO of the hospital, Wright Lassiter, who kind of understood, you know, when I went back and approached, you know, the hospital with the idea of resurrecting the project, you know, they wanted to know, you know, what story I wanted to tell, and I tried to communicate to them the best I could how I wanted to approach it. And I think they understood that I was more interested in, you know, the story of the community and the story of the institution struggling to care for that community without enough resources than I was in some of the typical things that happen at a public hospital, like the violence. And even though some of that's in the film, that wasn't going to be the focus of the film, and I think that they appreciated that. And they knew that their story was part of a larger story of, you know, what was going on in healthcare in America. And so I think there was a degree of trust there that allowed us to be in the hospital and capture some of these stories in a very intimate way. And you know, we did have protocol that we had to follow. We could never film anybody, identify anybody on camera without a release. And so, you know, if we couldn't get a release, you wouldn't see any identities like that young boy who was shot. But it was a remarkable kind of partnership between a filmmaking team and a large public institution that resulted in this film.
And some of the stories, I mean, my goodness, they, you know, the characters that make it into the film, I mean, they sort of give you a breath. I mean, we have the father who's been unemployed for for a year, and he and his ex-wife, you know, they have a really wonderful relationship around their children,
mm-hmm.
don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. And
so I think that's mm-hmm. you know, that's also, you know, that bond, you know, between the family, even though they were separated,
mm-hmm.
they were sort of joined together in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was something that that's something that the community as a whole is experiencing in the waiting room. You have people who come together from all different backgrounds. So you have, you know, Hell's Angels sitting next to, you know, immigrants sitting next to entrepreneurs, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or you know, people with mental illness. So there's a whole range of sort of humanity that comes together in this one waiting room, and they're bound together by sort of this common experience. And, you know, as a storyteller, that fascinated me, and I wanted to try to capture that in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I love the humor, particularly, you know, again, with the family, with the child who has a really high temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe one of the nurses says, you know, it's like, you have a radio station.
Right.
Well, that's
CJ.
Right.
I mean, she puts everybody at ease, and she's a remarkable caregiver, and she can do that with, she can do that with a 7-year-old girl and anxious parents, and she can do that with a gangster,
mm-hmm.
know. So I mean, she can engage a wide variety of people, and she doesn't judge anybody. You know,
mm-hmm.
everybody is a human being to her, and I think it's honest from
mm-hmm.
her, and you really get that honesty from her. And so, I mean, it was a no-brainer that she was going to be, representative of this institution that has got what I see as a very special and profound relationship with the community.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then, you know, CJ's, as, you know, the caregiver, I mean, she's reflected in, you know, Dr. White, whom we've already spoken of, but as well as, the other caregivers that are, you know, trying to resuscitate that child, and then they don't, you know, he
mm-hmm.
doesn't live, and then like sort of trauma therapy in the moment,
right.
Like, you know, you did all you could. I mean, it's like, I know, and then you follow. I mean, I like that you had all that in there, like that someone dies and everyone is affected, not just those that were related to the person who dies.
Yeah, I think it has a profound, I mean, the whole, you know, sort of day in and day out, I think has a really
mm-hmm.
significant impact on the caregivers who work there, and it that was part of what we wanted to try to communicate with the film, is that this is the special nature of like who these people are, who these caregivers are,
mm-hmm.
doesn't end just with their skill in providing healthcare. It's in their ability to, you know, witness and take in really some very difficult realities that people are dealing with, you know, whether it's violence or whether it's mental illness or whether
mm-hmm.
it's poverty or homelessness or, you know, or economic problems. You know, they're seeing these people day in and day out, you know, whose problems extend far beyond their health, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an impact, you know, and especially for a young doctor like that doctor in that scene, that was the first time he had, a patient of his had died. And so
mm-hmm.
seeing, you know, what does that mean to a young person about to begin a career? Was really quite profound.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and then the more experienced doctor telling him, okay, well, if someone dies as a result of a crime scene, then the body doesn't belong to the family; it belongs to the coroner, and they have to. You know, that was like, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know all those details about how the family could see their loved one through a glass, but the body's not released until after, because the body is like a witness or is evidence or something.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of what happens when you get sick or when, you know, you lose control. I mean, that's part of the story of our healthcare
mm-hmm.
system is there's so much anxiety over it because it represents for everyone a moment of losing control, like
mm-hmm.
when you're sick or
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're shot or if you're in the care of you know, a medical institution, or if you're at the mercy of a you know, health insurance industry or healthcare system, you've lost some degree of control, and I think that's part of why the healthcare issue is such a wrenching one for some people, and has become such a divisive and ideological debate, is because at the heart of we all have that moment where we're not in control, and I think that the ultimate example of that is in the story of that young boy who when he dies, you're right. I mean, the family doesn't even have a say in when they can and how they can view the body. So mm-hmm. those are just little details that we witnessed. That every little detail that I saw in there had like a bigger meaning, or had a symbolism, or there was a metaphor in it that that sort of struck me as we filmed various scenes, whether they directly had to do with the healthcare mm-hmm. issue or not.
Right. Yeah. Well, tell me about the larger meaning of I've got two. The man who Dr. White was wondering why the hospital sent him to emergency for dialysis, and my father was
right.
a renal patient, so I understand that.
Yeah.
And he had just become a dialysis patient, so he wasn't really familiar with the details. It seemed like what was going to happen, he had to be dialyzed 3 times a week, and it's like to have to go to an emergency room to do that, and it already takes all day to do it anyway. And so he was just really, really, really angry to the point of, just take this thing out of me and I would just go home and die, if that's what it means.
Yeah,
and
I think that's an extreme, that's an extreme sort of, example, but it for us it represented that feeling that we all have had
mm-hmm.
in trying to negotiate, bureaucracy at a moment when we're, sick, or in a moment when we're vulnerable. And I
mm-hmm.
think that moment kind of symbolized the frustration that a lot of people have in dealing with the healthcare system, whether they have insurance or whether they don't have insurance. And here's this guy that for some people might consider him difficult to sympathize with because he's a difficult guy to deal with,
mm-hmm.
But the reality is that people share that feeling is familiar. And so that's why we decided to include it in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have someone comes in and they say, they show us how this person has come in like maybe for the past 7 or 8 months, maybe a couple of times each month, to the point that the doctor knows the person's name. And I just love it that, he is not like, okay, this person came in on an ambulance and we're not going to rule anything out. So just because he knows this man's, he doesn't say, okay, well, we're not going to run all these tests because he's not certain. He talks to him and the person is, he's out of it, so he can't answer, really clearly about some of his symptoms. And I just love the human dignity that all of the caregivers treat the patients with. I mean, it's just like,
yeah.
Wow. I mean, and the human dignity that these people who are, human beings like all of us, this dignity that they are given, which is what they deserve, is not something they get on the other side of the doors.
Well, I think with Carl's case, and they do know these folks by name, and they come in. And here's another patient that on the face of it might be difficult
mm-hmm.
to sympathize with, but the reality is that human beings, whether you're liberal, conservative, gay, straight, rich or poor, addiction is something that affects everybody,
mm-hmm.
and it's part of the human condition, and it's part of the reality of our healthcare system that we have to treat folks with addiction. That leads to all kinds of other problems. It leads to them coming back to the hospital multiple times. It leads to them not taking care of themselves. And so we wanted to, put that question out there for people to consider. What do you do with a person like that? In this case, the hospital does what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
They leave no stone unturned. They treat him like this is the first time he's been into the hospital. They treat him like, he's not necessarily on the street and drug addicted, but they treat him like anybody would be, like a banker, like you run every test, you do everything you can do to find out, how to treat the patient. And so that kind of level of respect and professionalism is something that we all want to be treated with when we come into the hospital. And you know, despite people's feelings about drug addicts or homeless folks, I mean, they you know, they deserve, and my judgment as a storyteller anyway, they deserve that same level of treatment. And we saw that kind of professionalism and empathy from the entire staff at the hospital, and that's what's so special about Highland is they're dealing with a very challenging patient population, many of whom society kind of writes off, you know.
Right. Yeah, and it's really interesting, you know, think about Highland General Hospital and its history, that was the first University of California. It was right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then
Highland?
Yeah, at Highland. That was the first University of California, and then it moved to Berkeley. And then it was really well known for, you know, as a mental institution,
mm-hmm.
you know, prior
mm-hmm.
to becoming, you know, mm-hmm. the hospital that it is now.
Right.
Yeah. But, I also wanted to, for you to talk about, you know, I just thought it was really great, sort of the things that the doctor would say, well, if the patients knew that someone was stabilized and instead of sending them home, we allowed them to stay in the bed because if I sent them out, he would be on the streets. He had no place to go. And then you talk, you know, we talk about sort of the illness of substance abuse and, you know, people have these programs that they're in, and then if they go out and use, then they might get kicked out, which is what happened to I believe Carl, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they said, no, you can't come back. You keep on relapsing too much. I'm
right.
like, okay, so what happens? You know,
right.
you throw people on the
pastor,
street. Yeah,
even his pastor got fed up. I mean, that's part of the challenge of substance abuse is that
mm-hmm.
it frustrates, you know, and for the medical staff, it's not so much a question of you know. How to treat the drug addiction per se.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, what do you do with a patient if he has no place to go, if you know you're going to put that patient back out on the street? Because the reality is if you put somebody right back out on the street and they're not able to take care of themselves, they're going to end up right back in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that costs the hospital money, it takes resources, and, you know, nobody wins in that situation. So it benefits them to try to place him, to try to find, even if it means having him stay in the hospital an extra few hours or even a day,
mm-hmm.
to find a placement for that patient. But the problem with that is that it creates a backup in the waiting room because somebody's waiting for that bed,
mm-hmm.
and that somebody's gonna have to wait longer for that bed to free up because that represents Carl in that room, represents a bed that you know, needs to be freed. So it's really a conundrum, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very challenging math that the staff has to deal with in terms of what to do with patients, you know, preventing a patient from, you know, going back out on the street versus freeing that bed up. It's a very hard choice to make.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then you let the caregivers and the people that are waiting talk about what the wait means. I mean, when I'm trying to think, I don't know if it was DeVillo or not, but he said that someone was supposed to call him and he comes back in a week and they say, oh no, like a month or so. He said, even if I'm in pain, he said, So it's like, you know, we will get to you, but you're going to be in pain for a lot longer. You know?
Yeah. The clinic waits are a long time. I mean, you know,
yeah.
you can come in and, I mean, the wait will be, you know, considerable if you're not dying.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, you can even be bleeding like that guy who had been shot a couple
mm-hmm.
days earlier, who had the bullet wound that was,
mm-hmm.
you know, acting up. You know, you can wait in there for a long time. And,
mm-hmm.
But that's for that, you know, immediate issue. The clinics and sort of getting to see a specialist, that's a whole other issue, and sometimes
mm-hmm.
those waits extend months, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another piece of the challenge of the safety net system that we wanted to try to illuminate a little bit. I mean, I think
mm-hmm.
it's a lot more complicated, and there's a whole other story to be told, but, you know, you could at least see you know, on the surface that it's a challenge.
Right, yeah. And then you sort of juxtapose Highland General Hospital with, you know, an HMO like Kaiser Permanente, and you have Kaiser seeing, you know, Eric Morgan, who has a diagnosis of testicular cancer, and then as soon as they, after they schedule, they do all the tests, and they schedule the surgery, and then they, I don't know, then they, I guess they ask him the question about coverage, and they, he doesn't have it, and they kick him out. I mean, they like, he's
well,
supposed
to. Well, they
didn't
kick,
kick
him
out. He was never in. Yeah, he, they just don't.
Right, he
don't
was never a member, and, you know, Kaiser.
Yeah.
You know, they tried to find an HMO that would take them without insurance, and Kaiser was one of the few that would take him. So in a sense, they did him a favor. But they didn't know that he had a tumor. He just had some issues, and so, you know, you can, the initial doctor's visits, or, you know, you can put on a credit card, and if you're not a member, you can, you know, put your credit card down. They give you a temporary number, and you can go through, you know, do it that way. But what happened was, there was a series of tests very rapidly that led to the realization that he had a tumor, and then the surgery was scheduled very quickly, and then it all happened so quickly that, you know, there's no way for Kaiser to, you know, foresee that that's going to happen. But when you, when it's time for a $30,000-$40,000 surgery, you can't put that on a credit card. So they basically at that point said that, hey, you're not covered. You know, you can't get the surgery.
Oh, okay.
You get a huge bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so what do you do at that point? Well, you go to Highland, and so that's how they ended up at Highland.
Right, right, yeah, and I love the class, you know, the subtle class system stuff that happens, you know, when they're waiting at the bus stop. Is it safe out here to wait for the
right.
bus?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, and
they were asking us. They were
they were talking to you. I thought they were talking to the other people at the bus stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny. Not yeah. funny, but you know, I was like, oh, I guess they've never caught a bus over here in this part of town before.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about Highland. It you know, all types end up over there, you know, and for a variety of reasons. I mean, that's where, you know, when Obama comes into town, his Secret Service team, that's where they go. They go to Highland, and because that's where Obama would go if he was ever in need of emergency care.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the trauma center for the Bay Area.
Right.
And that's where if there was a disaster or earthquake or something like that, you know, Highland would be the sort of the home base of caring
for
the entire community. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. I mean, that's where, you know, Highland's got the best trauma center. And there aren't that many trauma centers in the Bay Area, so in the East Bay. Anyway,
right.
I think Eden's the next closest
to Hayward
trauma center. But if you're like in like, you know, if you're like in Hayward, San Leandro, Oakland, East Oakland, Berkeley, you're going to Highland.
Wow.
And that's where you want to go if you want your life saved.
Yeah, they're very good at that, because you have some testimony in the waiting room. Like, this woman talks about a really bad car accident she has where her car was wrapped around a pole or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, and then the man shows his an incision where he had open heart surgery just a week before, and he's walking around like, whoa.
I am.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, the people over there, they're hardcore. You know, they've lived such hard lives, and that's just life.
Mm-hmm.
That's just life to them, and you know, and they get by, and they take what comes next, and that's part of the remarkable story of that collection of people in that waiting room.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. I just sort of was put in sort of thought about, you know, sort of the line going into heaven and, you know, the waiting room there, and I talked to people that were elders, and they would say, I'm in God's waiting room, sort of like, you know, they know they're gonna be called soon.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of like waiting, and then even you know, nurse assistant CJ says when she's doing intake on the neck, you know, when she comes back after she, you know, she goes home, she says, oh, it's going to be a long wait. And and she said, oh, I thought you'd look back at all the beautiful people. You know, and he was like, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, when you showed registered nurse Liz Lynch, you know, on the phone, you know, sort of trying to negotiate, you know, beds and movement of patients and looking at the chart on the wall and sort of monitoring that, it sort of reminds me of like a police station, like a command post.
A bit, yeah. I mean, it had that sense of sort of almost like a military operation.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we noticed that. I mean, that was one of the things that struck us, was that flow of beds and how what was going on behind the scenes to keep the beds moving and
mm-hmm.
keep the waiting room, to try to like work the waiting room down so that there wasn't so many people waiting. I mean, that fascinated us, and so at some point we decided that would be a structural device that we used to keep the film moving forward.
Mhm. Yeah. So how many patients were seen that day in the life that you did?
Well, we
I mean, how many were in
several
the
days? Yeah, we filmed over several weeks, actually.
Oh, okay.
And it was sort of a composite day in the life. We didn't spend more than 24 hours with any one patient.
Mhm.
And so, you know, we would just, you know, we just repeated the process over and over until we had enough different types of characters that we felt we could stitch it together. But you know, every morning we would, you know, queue up at the line and
mm-hmm.
meet somebody. And when we met somebody that we liked, that we felt we had good chemistry with, we
mm-hmm.
would just hang out with them for their day, for however long their wait was, whether it was 2 hours or whether it was 14 hours. And,
mm-hmm.
and we did that for several weeks. And then we had sort of a basket of characters, and we just went into the edit room and put it all together.
Mm-hmm. So how many stories did you collect, and how many cameras were there? Because I was wondering how you could be in the room itself, the waiting room, and then also be at the bus stop, or be with a patient in you know, one of the
Sure. That's the magic mm-hmm. of editing. I mean, we had one camera. There was that one extra camera
mm-hmm.
that was used for the family.
Yeah.
Because they got split up, and so, like, you know, sometimes the dad was with the young girl, sometimes the mom, and sometimes the dad was with the kids in the waiting
mm-hmm.
room. And so we actually had another person shooting on that day, but the rest of it was all one camera, and you just a lot of running around.
So you were the one doing all that running around?
Yeah, I shot it.
Wow. So what does Highland Hospital think of it, and what do the people that are in the film think of it? I know you've gotten lots of awards, like the Golden Gate through San Francisco International Film Festival, and congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they really appreciate the film and love the film because it tells their story.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, in some respects, it shows, you know, maybe what they don't want to emphasize, which is, you know, people, the long waits and all that. But on the other hand, it really reveals the humanity of the place and the humanity of the, not just the patients, but the caregivers as well. And I think it's a story that it just hasn't been told about, at least about Highland. I mean, there was a film that Fred Wiseman did, you know, for over 40 years ago in it was in Chicago. It was called Hospital, and it was a bit of a.
Oh, I remember model. That. Yeah, that's like
a
classic.
Model for this film.
Yeah.
So, you know, we sort of, you know, picked up where that film left off. We brought the audience a little bit more intimately into the, you know, characters and stories than I think Wiseman did, which was a more of a detached kind of observation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
More of a clinical kind of observation of this public hospital, but. I think, I mean, the reaction has been pretty profound from the caregivers at Highland and the patients at Highland who have seen it, you know, appreciate the film, and I think, you know, see it as a testament to what they do every day, and we're proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really agree with one of the people in the waiting room that talked about how instead of bailing out the banks and the car manufacturers, you know, money should have been put into healthcare. And you
right.
think about healthcare and education and housing, you know, those are basic human rights.
Yeah, according to some people. It depends on who you...
Well,
the
United Nations, it's according to the United... We didn't vote yes on it, but, you know, it's,
sure.
it's a government, but...
that's the thing about our condition, our situation right now, is
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, that view is not shared by everyone in this country. I mean, maybe half the country believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of what is it, a human right, what's a right versus a privilege, I mean, healthcare is definitely on the chopping block on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the, you know, backdrop, and that's part of the, you know, debate and conversation that we wanted to put this film into without ourselves making taking a position on that, you know, regardless
mm-hmm.
of what I believe personally. I didn't think that, you know, it was the film's role wasn't to take a position on that. The film's role was just to, you know, show, you know, to offer humanity to the people that we saw in that waiting room, because that's what we saw. I mean, you,
mm-hmm.
if you go in there, I mean, that's what you see. But, you know, I think there are some people who might see the film differently. We haven't screened the film widely in the United States yet, to the point where we would have a very, for instance, conservative audience, you know,
mm-hmm.
weigh in on it. We have had conservative people who have seen it who like the film,
mm-hmm.
but large audiences and sort of cohorts of people, we haven't quite experienced that yet.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is to the film once it hits places. Like, we're going to be in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
We open in Houston on the 17th.
Okay.
And, you know, that's a completely, you know, different environment out there, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're opening in the Bay Area on the 19th, so that's exciting.
Right.
Yeah, are you going to be at any of the screenings here in the Bay Area?
Yeah, in Oakland on the 19th and the 20th,
mm-hmm.
and then in San Francisco on the 21st,
mm-hmm. okay.
and then in San Jose, we're still trying to work out the San Jose schedule.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Is your film also going to be a part of, you know, the ITVS or anything like that? Is it going to happen?
Yeah, we were funded by ITVS, and so we'll be on Independent Lens on April 1st, 2013.
Oh, so you're part of that season coming up.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome, awesome. Any part twos to this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's been so much work involved in getting the film out there,
mm-hmm.
that, I mean, typically I'd be on to my next project, but because this thing has attracted so much attention and there's a lot of work to be done getting it out with
mm-hmm.
the theatrical release and all that, I haven't, I mean, we are thinking and we're talking about potentially doing something, because the healthcare story in particular sort of, as represented by Highland and
mm-hmm.
you know, ACMC as a whole, so you could certainly do another film. But for right now, I'm just sort of focused on getting the film out there and getting, you know, figuring out a model to you know, have the film be used by communities and medical schools and teaching hospitals
mm-hmm.
around the country, because we really need to get that structure in place so that the film can have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm putting a lot of work into that right now.
That's awesome. And what does your wife think?
Oh, she loves it. I mean, she's having a great time, and she's become my biggest fan. And she's out there handing out postcards and telling all of her coworkers about it. And you know, I think she's proud of it, because
mm-hmm.
she's also she's a caregiver at ACMC,
mm-hmm.
and she works over at Highland, and she's seen these stories. You know, over and over, and I mean, she was the inspiration for me wanting to make the film, so
mm-hmm.
it's been great too. I'm always bouncing ideas off of her, and I mean, while we were making the film, I would bounce ideas off her and ask her what she thought about this or how we represented that, and
mm-hmm.
so it's been great having her
yeah.
as a partner in
right.
life and all, but also on the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you all seem like a real wonderful, wonderful creative team. And lastly, I want to ask you, you know, to give a shout out to your, you know, the sound designer and some of the other folks that are sort of integral
yeah.
into the way the story and the film and all that looks.
There's so many people to give a oh my gosh, Linda Davis, the producer of the film, did just a phenomenal job guiding this film through the process. You know, through sort of fundraising, through production to post-production. She deserves just, you know, big hug. And then Lawrence LaRue, who, because documentaries are hard to make,
mm-hmm.
Lawrence, who edited the film, was also our sound recordist. And it was like a really challenging environment in that waiting room
mm-hmm.
to capture sound.
Yes.
And he had never ran sound for full film before, so it was remarkable that he was able to sort of quickly, you know, train himself. And then in the edit room, Jim Lebrecht at Berkeley Sound Artist did just a phenomenal job mixing and sound designing the film. And we've actually gotten quite a few comments. Everywhere we go, where we screen the film at Q&As, people ask about the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim Lebrecht, you know, big shout out to you, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, it was great. It was an amazing team. And so we're looking forward to getting all those guys up on the stage at the Grand Lake opening, so everybody can give them a big hand.
Oh, that's going to be lovely. Yeah,
yep.
Well, thanks so much for such a wonderful film. Really, really appreciate this story. And, yeah, and the people that allowed you to bring them in, you know, on screen, you know, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, those that are in the waiting room that we don't know their stories necessarily, and those that allow you to, you know, to tell their stories in a really intimate way, like
right.
you do, and in a really respectful way, too.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and I'm going to try to come out on the 19th.
Oh, yeah, come to the 19th at the 7 p.m. show and
all right.
tell all your friends.
Oh,
tweet
I certainly
that out.
Will. Okay.
Tweet it, Facebook, whatever you
all right,
whatever works for you.
Okay. You take good care.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Director Pete Nix talking about The Waiting Room, which, again, is opening at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on Friday. It's going to be a 7 o'clock screening, and he is going to be in the house. And then it's also opening in several other Bay Area theaters this weekend, and the director is making his rounds. We are joined in the studio by wonderful, wonderful director who, gosh, his work really precedes him, Charles Burnett. I mean, my goodness, I'm so happy you could join us to talk about your work in the L.A. Rebellion and your film that's screening at the City Film Archive tomorrow, along with the film by one of your colleagues, Larry Clark, passing through your short film, When It Rains, is going to be screening. And then last week, director Billy Woodbury talked about his thesis film, Bless Their Little Hearts, which was, you know, a piece that you wrote.
Yes. Yeah, I ran into him the other night, and he said he had a great time up there.
Yeah, it was really fun, because not all of the directors have been coming through, you know, when the L.A. Rebellion came north. And so it's just really, really nice when directors come and visit us, like Mr. Woodbury, and then Zainabu Irene Davis is going to be in the house next week on the 23rd. It's like, oh, I'm so excited.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was reading a little bit about you. We've spoken before. I think the last time we spoke was when you did the film about the first president of
Namibia?
Burkina Faso.
No, it was Namibia.
Oh, was it Namibia?
Yeah,
okay.
Namibia.
Okay, yeah, and you were were in Oakland for the Oakland International Film Festival. That was really nice. Yeah, did that film ever have a theatrical release in Namibia?
No, they're
so
still
nice.
Trying to get a theatrical release. It was going through a lot of lawsuits and things like that. So because of that, it's sort of like been on the shelf for a long time.
Oh yeah, it's a great film, and My Brother's Wedding, which also made it up north as a part of the LA Rebellion. It's a really wonderful film, and I hadn't realized that it was your second feature. I was reading.
Yeah, it was one of these kind of films that it was my second film. It needs to be re-edited. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that I didn't quite finish, and I wanted to go back and edit it, but I lost all the elements of it, in it, you know, so it can't be done now. I can only, like, trim it, and that's what I did.
Right.
For me, it was a rough cut.
Okay, yeah. And what I another thing I've enjoyed about seeing these films, you know, the shorts and the features, mm-hmm. was how I'll see, like, your name popping up in other people's films. I'm like, Charles Burnett directed this, or he did the sound on this one. It's just like, it's a real synergy between, you know, the directors in this particular period of filmmaking in Los Angeles. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, because when you came into filmmaking, you already had your undergraduate degree, and I believe that was in writing.
No, it was in film.
First of all,
I went to LACC and I got a degree in electronics there. Then I went over as undergraduate to UCLA and I got a degree in a BA in filmmaking. And then I went on to graduate school.
Right.
But one of the good things at UCLA at the time, like in the 60s, and it was dirt cheap. I mean, it was like $20, $25, I don't know. And one of the things you had to do, you didn't have to do, but it was expected of you to sort of work on everyone's film. You know, that's the only way you can get a film made, really, is to have crew that were members of the department or student body. And we all sort of, like, took it as, you know, the way to do things, you know. So it wasn't anything special. It was just the way things were done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the way, you know, Mr. Woodbury talked about it, it was like, you know, they had like sort of like the front guard, and you were among those folks. You know, you had been there, and then other folks came in as like a second and third wave, and so you sort of set the standard, and you're right, you know, it was really a supportive environment. However, you know, the other artists and other directors had to, you know, sort of be willing to participate in this sort of this process of art making with other directors in variety of different roles. Because he said, you know, the film, you know, When It Rains, he's actually in front of the camera on that one. And he said it was only for you that he would do that.
Yeah, that was nice of him. But, I think the thing was we grew up in, I guess, doing the civil rights movement and things like that, and it was a part of, you know, our condition and what shaped us, you know, to sort of help one another, you know. And so I think things have changed a bit now, you know. But then it was wonderful in that time period when, you know, you can call on your brother or sister to come and help you, and they were there.
Right, you know? Yeah. I mean, even to the point of having children from your family in his film.
Oh, yeah, that was my niece and nephew. But the thing was, you know, we exploited everything. You know, that was the only way to make film. Mm-hmm. And it was all fun. And so, you know, we profited by it. We learned a lot and developed friendships over the years. So just stayed.
Yeah. Right. So could you talk about a little bit more about you know, sort of that period of filmmaking and you know, even though, you know, you were born in Vicksburg, Mississippi, which is a real significant place, you know, for civil rights, the civil rights movement. And I don't know, did you go back and forth? Did your family go back and forth there?
We didn't go back and forth a lot. You know, we went back, and it was sort of not a pleasant thing, you know, because I remember we went back to Mississippi to visit our cousin in Vicksburg, and we had to go through New Orleans. We took a Sunset Limited train, you know, which is an integrated train leaving L.A. When we got to New Orleans, we had to change to a Jim Crow train. But while we were in New Orleans, you know, we were kids, and we saw this, like, playroom, you know. So we went in there, and my brother and I, and started playing with the little toys and things like that. Next thing you know, it was empty, you know. And the police and everything were around, and, you know, I called my grandmother, and, you know, and it was a big stink, you know. So we were the first ones, I think, to sort of unofficially integrated at the New Orleans train station. But it was a great experience because, you know, the South was more of a mystery to me because, you know, you hear your grandparents talk about it, I mean, mother and grandparents and everyone else talk about it because everyone in Los Angeles at the time was from the South, Arkansas, you know, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, all this sort of thing, you know. So I grew up listening to those tales, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when I went back to when I was old enough to go back and remember a lot of things, it was a really interesting and memorable time, if that makes any sense. I mean, you know, it's like you hear about all these fantasies and stories and things like that when you go back and realize what it's really like, you know. You know, because we were taught, you know, when you go back what to do and things like that and how to act. And I mean, my mother hated Mississippi. She said she'd never go back, you know. So it was just sort of wondering, what is this place, you know? So we had a chance to visit and see, and that was, you know, a lasting experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, just sort of thinking about the film, Jemma Fanica's film, Emma May.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of how, you know, how these films, you know, that are a part of the of this now catalog, you know, the L.A. Rebellion, you know, the New Direction of Black Cinema, sort of like, you know, with Julie Dash, you know, looking at the South and then others looking at, like, Emma May, looking at, you know, sort of the immigration to the West and sort of how those two cultures sort of communicate with one another and reach some kind of agreement and also some common language, which it does in that film, and then your films are really, I mean, we know they're in the city, but they don't have to be necessarily. You know, one thinks about, you know, Killer of Sheep, It doesn't necessarily have to be in, you know, it could be somewhere else. It could even be in another country, because it's, you know, it's really about character and about, you know, the intensity of the story that you're telling. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of, you know, your themes that seem to run through most of your films that I know of, and like, for instance, in My Brother's Wedding, which you were talking about, and it's about a family and about a young man in particular who has to make a decision and make a choice, and he, you know, he's got a lot going for him insofar as the elders love him, and he seems to be a really good son to his mother and father, doesn't seem to be really living up to his potential, and then he's got this, he just really sort of just blows it in one wrong move on the day of his brother's wedding. Oh, did I lose you? Oh, no. Oh, I think I lost my guest. Oh, heck. Okay. Well, I think I lost my guest. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to call him back. And in the meantime, I will play Meglit Hadaro's Walls, and I'll be right back with Charles Burnett.
Be gentle, be gentle, gentle with me. I feel a fragile this year. Be gentle, gentle with me and the voice. This counted 10,000 walls around my heart now. Can't see my eyeballs, my walls. Some are made of cardboard and some are made of clay. Some are made of memories for that sad, sad day. Oh, I know every single one of my walls, my walls. Oh, I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of them. I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of my I.
Well, that is Meglit Hadaro singing Walls, and we've got Charles Burnett back in the studio. And hopefully you can remember what you were saying before we were disconnected.
I think I was talking about being in Mississippi and going back and
mm-hmm.
And you know, using that material for things that I'm making films about and things like that. I think that's what I was talking about.
Yeah. So how does the South, you know, sort of show up in your films? And you know, you were raised in Watts, which is a real sort of volatile and real significant place in Los Angeles African American history, and I really like how the films that we've seen so far, they're all set within the community. I mean, they're in Watts, they're in Compton. It was like it's really like in the hood, and just really wonderful being able to see how family, black family, lives, you know, in a variety of different ways. It's not necessarily everyone's living the same.
Yeah, no, Watts was a great place when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was downtown Watts. You know, I went to a school right across from Jordan High School called Great Elementary. Not Great. It was called, what was it called? I can't remember the name of the school now. You know, anyway, it was an elementary school, and I don't know, it was called Garmin. And so we used to walk right through 103rd all the way down home. I lived about 2 or 3 miles from the school. But anyway, we had to catch a bus there. But it was fun walking down through, you know, the main avenue, which was 103rd home. And it was a community of working class people. You know, it was that was before the civil rights movement. So you had a mixture of just about every economic group there. You know, and you had people who had trade, you know, jobs and you know, carpenters, plumbers, and all this sort of thing, brick masons, all that kind of stuff. You know. And it was a fun place to be. And people, you know, buying their homes. There was a lot of ownership and stuff like that, more than renting. And it was just, I enjoyed it, you know. You know, you had to know how to box in order to get, you know, to get by. But other than that, it was, but later on, you know, in the 80s and 70s, things changed throughout, you know. But at that time, it was a great place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had some of the best track teams and football teams, you know. It was fun for dances and stuff, you know. It was, you know, it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so how you know, sort of when you think of your character, for instance, the young man who is real central in my brother's wedding,
uh-huh.
and he's just such a, I mean, he's just seen to have so, has, he has so much potential that it seems to be wasted, and one wonders about his friend and his tolerance and love of his friend, because there are only two of them left. Everyone's died or been killed or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complicated story in a sense that it's the only two things that are autobiographical is the incident where I promised a young lady who had just moved to town and we had made friends and everything that I would go to her wedding. And we'd agreed and all that sort of thing like that. And then sometimes later, a friend of mine was killed. And strangely, the wedding and the funeral was going to happen at the same time. And so I had, was going to the young lady to tell her that I can't make it, you know. Before I can even open my mouth, she seen this look in my face, and she said, "You're not going to tell me you're not coming to the wedding, you know." And I was too chicken to say, what my real reasons were. I needed to go to this funeral. I just said, yes, I'll be there. And I thought I can do both, but I couldn't. And I ended up not going to the funeral. And I really felt bad about it because that was sort of a permanent thing, you know, that it seemed to be more important to some extent. But anyway, because it was a friend of mine, we grew up together and stuff like that. And so anyway, I chose to go to the wedding, thinking I would be able to leave as soon as they get their vows, I'm gone, you know. But, of course, weddings never go off on time, you know. So I was stuck, frustrated, and things like that, and it happened. But that's the only thing that was, you know, sort of biographical in a sense. The other thing was that I wanted to do a story about a young man who sort of romanticized the poor and had this totally distorted notion about the middle class, which we were growing up, that's what we did, you know. That's the sort of feelings we had, you know. Anybody who was trying to become something was, you know, like trying to be uppity or whatever it is, or better than he was or she was and things like that, you know. And so it was one of these, you know, two-way streets where we both looked down on each other to some extent, you know, some of these class things. Anyway, so I wanted to sort of talk about a person who's supposed to be a brother's keeper, and that means you have some responsibility, but young people who really never grew up, you know, in a sense, and Pierce does it, the main character doesn't, you know. He hates his brother's wife because he has this, you know, this notion, this false notion that, you know, she's what he's called bougie or from the, you know, upper class and things like that, and have these, you know, certain attitudes that he imposes on her. And she doesn't have them, but he imposes them. He makes her have them, you know, things like that. And he likes his other friend who's totally, you know, a kid who needs direction. He needs a guide or someone with responsibility. And so it's like the blind leading the blind to some extent, because even though Pierce is a good person, deep down, he's incapable of managing anybody else, you know. And he's given that task of taking care of his friend who just got out of jail, you know. He's sort of a guy who has problems, you know, and so Pierce assumes the responsibility and he fails at it, you know, and he's caught in his trap where at the end he has to go to his funeral or his brother's wedding, and he chooses to try to do both and he fails at it, you know. And so it's sort of a sad, tragic thing in one hand. So it's about, you know, that if one hope that people look at it, they can see that, you know, you really have to make a decision. You have to be mature in many ways. You know, you just can't assume the responsibility of somebody else. You know, it's a big task and a big responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, but that's where that came from. You know?
Right. Yeah. And then When It Rains, your short film, Mr. Woodbury mentioned last week that you made this film. You're like, you had just finished, I think, To Sleep With Anger.
No, it was. Oh. I just finished this police movie called The Glass Shield.
Oh, okay, yeah. Uh-huh. That was a good movie.
Yeah, I was working on a production where it's sort of independent with bank money and that sort of thing like that. You kind of like feel constricted, confined in a way. Mm-hmm. It's like a big machine behind you that keeps moving, and it'll roll over if you stop. And then it's all these other considerations, commercial considerations, that you feel that you don't have the same freedom if it was your own film. And so when we finished, I was wanting to do something that was sort of therapeutic in a way, and just do something on my own where I can just do whatever I want and just have fun doing it, Mm-hmm. And so this, and When It Rains came out of that, a bunch of friends got together, we just went out and shot it in, a short period of time and had fun doing it.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So that's sort of like, you would sort of like, sort of a unwinding film, and also, like you said, being able to do what you wanted to do.
Yeah, but also wanted to deliver sort of an ironic message,
Mm-hmm.
And so it was about, the thing is, I used to live in these apartments, and, L.A. is a funny place because you can, if you want to hide from anyone, move to L.A. because you can live right next to the person that you're looking for and not know it until he moves, Then you meet each other in the hallway and you say, oh, it's you, But like in New York, as big as New York is in Manhattan, every time I go to New York, I run into people I don't want to see, But in L.A., you can be looking for them, and they can live right next door to you, and you would miss them. So I had this experience in my apartment, and the my neighbor was a writer, and I didn't learn about that until he was packing up and leaving, and we had this conversation just as he was leaving. I just said, darn, you're right next door, and we could have had a nice chat every now and then, about writing it and your work. And but there are other examples of that. So anyway, in the story, When It Rains, it's all about there's this incident that could have been solved easily.
Mm-hmm.
If, like the guy at the end said, if I'd have known that you like music and I like the same music, we could have found the common ground and resolved this solution, This guy was, for the longest period, looking for the landowner. What the story is, his landowner is kicking this lady out and her daughter because they hadn't paid the rent in a while. And she comes begging him to ask for an extension, and he says, no, I've given you too many. And so she gets her friend, who actually is Babu, who runs the Pan African Film Festival,
mm-hmm.
to help her find someone who can loan her the money. And her husband refuses, and then because they're separated. And so he goes around trying to collect some money. But he runs into this guy at the very end who's a trumpet player, Juno Lewis, who played with a lot of great, he's a real guy who played with a lot of great musicians. Anyway, he is playing his trumpet, walking down the street, and this guy asks him for a loan, and the guy says, I don't have any money, but I have this album, so of John Handy. And so it looks like everything is falling apart. And so he goes back to the manager, with the woman and her daughter, and he says, look, brother, we only have part of the money. Would you take part of the money? In the meantime, he's sort of waving the album around to try to explain things, and the manager sees the album and says, wait, that album, John Handy, I'm looking for that album for the longest. And come on in. Maybe we can make a deal. He invites him into his house, and he says that he was glad he didn't have a rap album in his hand, And so it was the sort of thing about a comment on music and blues, and also the, where we came from as people, as well. So it's a little bitty film that has a lot to say, I think, and so
mm-hmm.
it was fun trying to squeeze everything in and make it work.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, and it makes sense now that you explained the film, why it's being a part of the program with Passing Through. The film directed by
Larry Clark,
yeah, because that film is looking at sort of, black music as a vehicle for black history.
Mm-hmm.
And this person sort of going back, finding himself, sort of going back to the repository of sort of the essence of his soul, which is a musician. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's his grandfather, Papa.
Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. Yeah, I was looking for some of the films that I remember seeing your name in the credits, Your Children Come Back to You. That was a really nice film.
Sharon, Lily Larkin?
Uh-huh,
yeah. Is she going to be up there?
Nope.
Oh, it'd be nice if she come, because she's, you know, like many of us struggling, you know. And it'd be nice for her to get a vacation or something to go up and let the audience, you know.
Yeah, that would have been nice to see her, because her movies, I mean, like the other one, A Different Image, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
That was really good, because they did like all these films by women directors 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, and so she featured really prominently, and it's like, oh, it's Charles Burnett's name.
Yeah, she was great to work with, and very talented. Unfortunately, a lot of people, and, you know, we started earlier, so there wasn't, you know, places where one could go, you know, screen their films, and also to get, some cachet out of it, like by getting jobs and things like that, beyond just student films and things like that. Because these people are just as talented as anyone working today or in the past, you know.
Right.
And, you know, it was just, you know, being people of color and a woman and all that kind of stuff was, you know, kind of difficult, to say the least.
Yes, and it would be really great if some of these films, you know, were available outside of, you know, an academic archive, because, I mean, a lot of these films, I think all of these films except one, Bush Mama, I had never seen, and directors I had never even heard of, and I'm like, wow. I mean, this is just like when there's a screening for the L.A. Rebellion, you know, creating a new black cinema, whatever there might be happening. I mean, I've skipped concerts. I've skipped going to lectures. I mean, it's like, okay, well, the 18th, I'm going to be at PFA.
Oh, I'm glad I expect you that way. But you know what would have been great? If these films would have had this years and years ago.
Yeah.
You know, would have had an impact on younger filmmakers and particularly female filmmakers and things like that. These would be good examples of what one can do. And it would, you know, because these films, I think, are films about something. You know, they're not about getting jobs in Hollywood, but they're about commenting on, you know, the filmmaker's reality, what was going on at the time, you know, things like that, about social issues, you know, and their personal stories, a different narrative than the ones that Hollywood has been, you know, perpetuating on people, you know. And now if you go to film schools and things like that, now it costs so much to go, but people are more interested in getting into making films that are going to, you know, give them exposure and things like that to getting them a job and things. Because these films are very original, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, they really are.
A lot of originality in them, and sincere and honest about what they're trying to do, and it's all about that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Story. And then some of these directors, you know, they're no longer with us. You know, Jamal Fanica, he passed last year.
Yeah, just it was this year, I think.
This year?
I think it was because we had the thing. It was either early this year or late last year.
Well, I know he did that talk,
And that was in November, I think, and then December, and I think it was soon after that he passed away.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was so sad because he was such an inspiration in many ways. He was always enthusiastic, and, you know, he's one of these kind of guys that call you up and say, I saw your film, and I really, you know, you did a really great job and so forth. We ought to get together and vice versa. He's very supportive throughout, you know. And one of the things about him when he was at film school that people don't realize is Jamal came armed with material he wanted to do, and like he wasn't afraid of, you know, it's a film that it wasn't an issue with him. It's like, I guess I'm going to make this film, you know. There wasn't any obstacles or hurdles that, you know, some people get that and technology frightens them, you know. How I'm going to do this or anything like that. He just jumped right in the water, both feet, you know, and started making films, feature films, If you teach school, you run into students who are afraid to do anything with over 2 minutes or something like that, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you know.
Right.
They say, well, you know, start worrying. You say, go out and do it. You know, just put one foot in front of the other and do it. And Jamal was like that. He was very down to earth, and that was the next thing that was very good about him. He can work an audience too, so he was good. Too bad he left, you know, us. And but anyway, some speak for themselves, and can't say enough about these guys.
Yeah. So what's going on now with this sort of this brother sisterhood of black filmmakers? What's it like for you now as a director? Because you've been doing this for a long time.
Well, not exactly. I mean, the thing about it is, you know, it's like I've been alive for a very long time. But I haven't been working every day at it, every year, because that's what I mean by when someone says you've been doing it a long time. I've been thinking about it, but you don't really have a chance to sort of do it, you know.
Mm.
It's so infrequent, you know. You may, you know, do it every, you know, if you're lucky, 5 years, I mean, average out or something like that.
Oh, wow, okay.
Or, but with digital camera, it may be a little easier, it's easier to do that, but you may be able to do it, but distribution is another thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it there's a lot of people who moved on to do other things rather than make films because there's no work. I mean, not only the director, but just in terms of the crew or the craft people behind you.
Mm-hmm.
My sound person, I used Vita camera for a very long time and has done most of a lot of these films, couldn't make a living, and she just went to Atlanta to live with her mother for a while, you know, till something comes along, you know. But she lost a car and everything, and a lot of people have done that, you know,
mm-hmm.
who and if you can't do it, you know, because there's no money.
Huh.
It's not an easy feel to survive in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you were gonna be, you were going into, were you gonna be an engineer?
Yeah, and I wonder about that. Did I make a good choice? Because I tell you, I mean, I ran into this guy who this was before computers came, and the guy's making a mint now because he makes these chips, you know, and now he's able to support big movies and finance these big budget films through his electronic company, you know. I wasn't cut out. Hello, is that?
Yeah, keep on going. That's no problem. Yeah.
But looking back, I mean, those people that have those jobs like that are working constantly, I think. Mm-hmm. I have a plumber that comes to my house, he charged me an arm and a leg to just, you know, unstop the sink, you know. And I'm saying, what? You only been there 5 minutes, you know, and you're going to charge me over $90 for that, you know. It's like, I'm saying, you know, that's what would have been, you know, something as a minor to go into, you know, because you can always find work doing those kind of jobs, building a carpenter, things like that. But if you're an artist and things like that, you're called to do this, you know, and you'd be frustrated if you don't even try, you know. But, it's been a good living for me, and I've met a lot of wonderful people and got a lot of places because of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, you mentioned what I was, my experience in Mississippi. I'm back there now, actually.
Oh, really?
Not right now, but,
yeah.
You know, I'm working on this documentary about integrating hospitals in the South, particularly in the South, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole new area that a lot of people don't know about, understand how, what was going on in the hospitals in the South, not only in the South, but throughout the country. A lot of hospitals wouldn't admit black patients.
Right.
And wouldn't admit them no matter how bad they were in some cases, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was one of these kind of things where sitting at the counter is one thing. You know, not being able to sit at the counter right in front of the buses is awful. But not being allowed medical treatment. Your child, the mother, wife, whatever it is, or you, is inhuman. More so than any other aspect of racism you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And we have forgotten about that. And so we're visiting that and talking to these people who were also involved in a civil rights movement that we know, you know, the marches and things like that. But this was a movement that was started by doctors, dentists and nurses, you know. And it was very quiet and low-key, comparatively speaking, to the stuff you see with dogs biting people in water hoses and things like that sprayed on people. This was done in a more, I don't know how to describe it, but it wasn't, I mean, people were threatened, a person was, people were killed in the movement and things like that. But it brought a lot of really wonderful people together who are a lot of them are still alive today. And they're very special people. You know, and so it's really wonderful that just looking back and talking to these people because, you know, you discover all these things about, you know, how we as people are very heroic in many ways, you know, and what we've done. And I think not only the population, but people of color need to see, you know, these kinds of things, you know, the history of black people that are demanding and, you know, going after what is morally right, you know. It's just when you read those stories and hear these stories, they're just unbelievable. And you would think that no country would, you know, condone or tolerate that kind of stuff, but they did for many years, you know.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you'll be making a film about the healthcare system, you know, that served black people during, you know, the re-election and election year. And we're talking about Obamacare, right?
Oh yeah, but you know, two things. I don't know if your audience have read this book called Medical Apartheid.
Oh yeah.
It's awful. It's one of these devastating books. It's almost as bad as Ghost of King Leopold and its atrocities and things like that. It's just awful. But that's what they were doing in an equivalent of that kind of stuff. But it's. I don't know. It's just beyond one's imagination what we've suffered. And the thing about it is, you know, one of the other things that's very interesting is that we're looking back on people, you know, we're talking about, you know, Romney and people saying, well, we need less government and less regulation. Well, it was the government in this particular case that made it work. They created Medicare, Medicaid, all this kind of stuff, and it was, of all people, a Southerner, Lyndon Baines Johnson, mm-hmm. would turn out to be one of the best presidents we had.
Yes.
When you look at the history of Medicare and health care and desegregation, he stands out.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that worked for him said, he said he wanted this to end now. Mm-hmm. And he's going to lose votes, he's going to lose elections, but he wanted it to end now. No politics, he wanted it. It's wrong. And I take my hat off, you know. Mm-hmm. Take my hat off to him for that.
Yeah, because, you know, people give John F. Kennedy, you know, the credit for the legislation, but it was Johnson that signed into law, you know, some really wonderful legislation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In Medicare, he said, these hospitals in the South, if you don't treat these patients, you don't get the money.
Mm-hmm.
And money speaks. And that's what got in Medicare, you have to treat these people. And I don't mean, he said, I don't need any hocus, you know, what do you call that stuff, phony things about this, because they tried everything. You know, he had commissions people to investigate that. And they said, if you don't comply, you won't get it. And he was very serious about it. And these people believed him, and they came along without, you know, a lot of the protests and stuff like that. And but they created hospitals and things like that in the South, particularly Mount Bayou and things like that. It was... that's what needs to be told, you know, and this country needs to hear that, to inspire people, to get out and say, you know, if you participate, if you march and you struggle and demand certain things, it can happen, you know, if you group together.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got off in this documentary. I'm sort of promoting this film that hasn't quite been made yet.
Well, you're still working on it. Yeah, so when you're looking at... having it available, and where is it going to be on television, or is it going to be
hopefully it'll be on television someplace. We've actually been shooting, but we're trying to get the money as we go and getting grants. You know how long that takes. You know,
right.
Stopping, applying, and trying to, you know, inch our way along with, you know, this trickle down of money coming from different places. So, yeah, we've interviewed a lot of great people like Alvin Poussaint, Charles Evers, Meg Evers' brother, and people like that. And, and also Bob Smith and people who was the one of the initiators of it, and all these wonderful people who are still active today. And one of the things that's interesting about them is, you know, they're special because even though they're aged, they are still youthful in many ways. You know, they're still engaged and still politically active and stuff and fighting for causes. So that itself is another story,
right.
A part of this.
Right, that's excellent. That's really excellent. So, what do I want to ask you? You just got back from Brazil. Are you working on something there as well?
No, I was there because they did a group, can't pronounce the name of it anyway. They did a retrospective of three filmmakers.
Oh,
and,
nice.
I was one of them, and so are other people.
Okay. Who are the other directors?
Oh, the one who's going to ask me that.
I mean, did you know them already?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I must apologize. I don't get a chance to see too many films these days. Like,
you don't?
No. It's two things. One, the kind of films I want to see is kind of hard to see, and because, you know, it used to be where you can see these art films and foreign films, you know, anywhere, not anywhere, but a number of places that are convenient in L.A., but now everything is so far out. And also, I'm working on some projects, and I always feel strange leaving work I'm supposed to be doing to go see some other work, a film. It's like 2 hours I could be spent on this project, you know, and getting it further along. And so there's this anxiety when I go somewhere. I have to know it's going to be good and all this kind of stuff like that, or something to tear me away from it. So I'm trying to get out of that habit of feeling uncomfortable when I leave, you know, an empty page when I should be writing or something like that.
So you're really a disciplined artist.
No, it's a crazy sickness. You know, it's like when you do something, it's almost like this anxiety, I got to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you just sit at a blank sheet of paper and not write anything, you know, you feel as though, you know, you tried, you know. That was part of the process, you know. Maybe something would turn up on the page, but at least, you know, you feel as though you put an effort in. That's the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's sick, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. Ah, wow.
It's easy to get that way if you're in, you know, making films, independent film, and feel like you gotta, it's a living, and you gotta produce.
Yeah, put in that time. Mhm. Right. Yeah. So is this a feature that you're working on presently? That you are, as well as, you know, you mentioned the documentary.
Well, as a filmmaker, you have a number of pieces trying to get out, trying money for, you know.
Okay,
And so it's like, that's the other part that really is consuming, is that you spend a lot of time spinning your wheels trying to get something made, to get the financing for it, to get people to sort of come in to produce it and stuff. And so it's like this long, frustrating denial kind of a thing. You know, encourage, and they finally say, well, it's something we're not interested in, you know, or something like that. Or,
wow.
You know, it's denial is so much a part of this business, you know, and that's another frustrating thing that you have to live with.
Well, after encouragement, though, that's why you would think, okay, you get encouragement, then people are going to follow through.
Well,
not encouragement, and then, you know, they change their mind by the time you finish.
Yeah, well, you can't believe in that, you know. Everyone's excited about it, you can't. You have to take with a grain of salt and just say, well, I'll believe when it happens, when the check comes, and that's the only proof you have, you know, that it's going to work. People say a lot of things that they don't mean about, oh, it's a great piece, it's this and that, you know. And if you hear that a lot of times, and you never get anything done, you know, I mean, nothing's produced. It's a way of not, you know, just trying to be polite as opposed to say, no, we're not interested in the beginning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can string along for months, and they say, well, we haven't read it yet, you know, and that can go on for months and months. And so it's you know, it's the kind of business it is, you know. The only thing you can do is try to get the money to make your own film, but then you have to worry about distributing the film, how to get that done,
Wow. So within the program out of UCLA, the film and television program that you all came out of, there wasn't a distribution aspect to that? I mean, one would think after, you know, this, I mean, there are a lot of great films and that have been made, and the films that came out of that institution are just, like, phenomenal, and we're not even seeing all of them. So why not have, you know, a black distribution such as such and have a theater where we can show the films and a Netflix thing where we can get the films in or buy the films and watch the films.
Yeah.
Keep it all circulating.
Yeah, we tried a little bit, tried to get a group together. At one point, we're still students at UCLA, a group. But I think that's somewhat where the LA Rebellion came from, in a certain sense. And it wasn't, we didn't look at it as rebellion. We just looked at as a group of us who was a mass of students at the time, comparatively speaking, black student, who sort of came along. And there's a teacher by the name of LSL Taylor, who was really a great person, a black teacher there, who sort of helped to galvanize us in a certain direction. And we were already there in terms of our being people of color that we related very strongly and you know, formed the group. But he brought this whole third world cinema and made it more political in a way where it wasn't just a feeling, but it was more of a structural kind of a thing. And it's third world cinema class and everything like that. We're able to see films that we can relate to. But we had a chance to do that even before, but there wasn't a means of distributing film. We probably would have found one if we would have finally got together as a whole and formed the group, because the Hispanic Coalition did and the Asian community did, called the VC, Visual Communications, they did. We just didn't get off the ground. But again, we needed theaters or something. You can four-wall. At the time we were doing film, the unions were very strong, and you couldn't get to show a film that wasn't a union-made film in the theaters. Now it's changed a bit. Now, there wasn't Sundance or all these places you can take your film and sort of promote it and get it around. There was only several people who took the initiative, and that was Pearl Bowser, who really deserves a lot of credit, Pearl Bowser and Oliver Franklin. And there was also a lady here named Mamie Clayton here in L.A. who had an archive, and she wanted an archive, and she was the first one, I think, here that tried to preserve and keep these films, you know, archive and whatever it is, but it just wasn't. I mean, there wasn't enough. There wasn't a mechanism in place to distribute films as such, because one of the theaters, it's taking, it costs a lot of money. It costs in many ways more money to distribute a film than it is to make a film in many ways. Because, you know, you have advertising to do. It's really expensive, you know. Mm-hmm. And one way you can do it is four-wall a theater, and that was the only possible way. Or get little communities like Pearl Bowser and Oliver Franklin did at you know, like community centers and things like that to screen the film. Mm-hmm. There wasn't, the problem with that was that there wasn't any money made as such. To really get your money back, because you spend whatever amount of money on your film and you get a little money back and maybe showing it at community centers or something like that. But it's a long period to get, you know, recoup part of your money. You need an organization, and that's one thing as filmmakers we didn't do. We were filmmakers and not business people, and you need that kind of mentality in a way to get things run. Now, there's the Hudling Brothers came along with the Black Filmmakers Foundation in New York, and there was also another lady, Mabel something, I can't even name, who had a screening in her basement in New York. But the Hudling Brothers, I think, became one of the bigger sort of like distribution network entities, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they had Third World Cinema in New York, or Cinema Newsreel in New York, who were distributing these kinds of films later in the late 70s and 80s and things like that. But again, the money that you got from that wasn't enough to sustain an ongoing production for any particular filmmaker. It wasn't until the Europeans got involved and came over and invited a lot of the films to go to Europe and be screened at the Berlin Film Festival in France, in Berlin, and then in France, another festival that Catherine Ruel put on. And you have to mention the Uwe Gregor in Berlin, and Art Hesselink in Amsterdam, and people like that who brought a lot of independent filmmakers over, black independent filmmakers over, and invited to their festivals. And then it was like a shot in the arm. It was written about in all the art magazines, all the press and everything like that, and it was a novelty. And we were able to get money from German television and places like that, Channel 4, and that was a thing that helped to energize and to you know, create opportunities for filmmakers financially to go on and make other films, you know. I think every filmmaker that came out in the 60s, 70s were owed a great deal of debt to, you know, the European art houses and programmers like Art Hesselink and Uwe Gregor and Catherine Ruel, mm-hmm. and other folks. And so, but you know, even now, to get someone to distribute your film is very difficult. Although that you can, I've heard people talk about they've sold their films to certain rental places, DVD rental places and things like that, which ripped them off, you know, things. That's why I don't want to mention any names, but they had ripped them off, and now they're in the process of suing them for trying to get their money. But you can't do that sort of thing and make films and people take it from you and you can't get any, because you owe people money. If you hadn't paid your actors and things like that, you know, and they're expecting something, you know, to survive and things like that, you know, it's very difficult to maintain an existence.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you have this whole thing of piracy. And I was just out the other day, I was just getting my car fixed for the last 2 days, and I got to go back tomorrow because it still didn't fix it. it's killing me. But anyway, I was there, and this guy comes up in his car and want to sell me some videos, you know, or DVDs of some films, you know. And, of course, I'm against that because it robs you, independent filmmakers, of revenue. A studio has problems, and you know, but what really hurts the independent, people don't realize, are these people who pirate these films and sell them. Because, like, you know, $10,000 for an independent filmmaker to make is a lot of money to lose. Mm-hmm. And you can lose $50,000, $100,000 on these pirated films that could have, revenue could have gone to you, where you can go and pay for actors and other people, where you can create an industry. You can create, you can have jobs with people that they don't have to leave town to and you know, lose their apartment and car and to go back home, you know, and have to live with your mother and their father, whoever it is, you know. So there's a lot of issues that need to be resolved, you know, and we need to build an audience, you know, whereas, you know, that want to see. And a good example, like a lot of these film festivals, I know Oakland has a black film festival there with Jacques and everyone like that. Same thing with here in L.A. We have the Pan-African Film Festival where, and the Black Hollywood Film Festival, where the Pan-African Film Festival specifically does the diaspora, anything that deals with, you know, black people and that kind of stuff like that, particularly African films, and invite a lot of African filmmakers over. And the audience is great. The audience just, I mean, you know, you can't deny that, you can't say that there's not an audience there. It is, and it shows at the Pan-African Film Festival, people who are starving for films about themselves and about their culture and history and heritage, all this kind of stuff, they come in droves, and and they bring African filmmakers over, whoever, you know, or the filmmakers here who made films, whatever, and so you have this dialogue, great conversation with filmmakers, which is great. Mm-hmm. And Ava, what's her name? Ava DuVernay.
DuVernay.
Yeah.
Her film is opening tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's amazing. You know, she's just very businesslike and decided she's going to make these films and make a profit off of them, you know, and an industry. And going about it, you know, she's a great inspiration, you know, really a nice person and very articulate and stuff like that. And you can tell that, you know, she's going to be, you know, someone to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was standing under a tree the other day trying to wait for my car, and I think I get bitten by a spider on the neck.
Oh, my.
I hope it isn't one of those kind of flush, deteriorating spiders.
Oh, my goodness.
You can tell I'm a hypochondriac. Oh, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I get bitten by a spider.
Yeah, you have a creative mind. Wow, yeah. Oh, this is really interesting. Yeah, I want to mention that Ava DuVernay's film is called Middle of Nowhere, and it's opening. It opened in L.A. last week, I think, and it's opening here in Northern California tomorrow.
Tell your friends to come out and support it.
Yeah, it's really, really good film. Just like the film Beasts of a Southern
Wild
has really been taking off. It's still, you can still see it here, which is really wonderful.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah.
You're glad those kind of films exist and are showing people that, look, you know, there is an audience out there, you know, that they will support these kind of films. Just have faith in them and not try to hit a home run every time you make a film, you know.
But I'm glad that you're still making films, because, you know, your films are real, you know, beautiful documents of Black life and culture. And I mean, your families. I really love Killer of Sheep, because it sort of reminds me of Nothing But a Man. You know, that kind of classic.
Oh yeah, that's
kind
one of my favorite films. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your films are, you know, real classic like that. Particularly, you know, the ones that are black and white. It just look like, oh, they're just so beautiful, and your characters are so well developed, and your actors are so phenomenal. It's just like, and so I just, you know, it's really unfortunate that you're not a millionaire, you know?
I feel unfortunate, too. Hey, you know, if I was one, I wouldn't mind being one of those 1% or 2%, as I keep saying. Mm-hmm. Next time I get a salary, I want someone to get me in that bracket, even just for a minute, you know, whatever it is. Because, hey, it's no fun hustling, I tell you.
Yeah, because, you know, you could be doing that much more work if you didn't have to hustle. Like, okay, you make the film, you got to hustle for 4 years to be able to get it out.
But it's one of those kind of conditions that, you know, and you have to look at it from a different gaze, I suppose, because there's people who are worse off, you know, in many ways. And so it's looking back, it's been some challenges, but it's also been fun, and it's something, you know, it's my choice, and so it's not like someone's holding a gun to my head or anything like that. And it's something, when I do, I enjoy doing it, you know, just in between is a little difficult.
Obviously you love it. Are all your films made with film, or are you doing digital technology?
Well, I'm doing some digital now because it's inexpensive and it's easy to get in many ways. Film is a little bit too expensive. I'm also trying to work in 3D now as well.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Yeah. You know, taking some classes in 3D photography and stuff like that.
Oh,
I got this little 3D camera that you can buy really cheaply, you know, so I'm out trying to get familiar with this, you know, different format and stuff. It's fun.
Wow. So in the films that you're working on, sort of several at the same time, are you going to maybe incorporate some of that 3D technology into
it? Not the ones I have on the table now, but later on I will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely. I see some use for that. And so I'm just getting, you know, learning all the ins and outs of it so I can sort of, as I'm playing around with it now, so I can sort of like make something soon, short or something.
Oh, wow, that's
awesome. It's not just to be in 3D, but it's to take advantage of, you know, the aesthetics and what you can do and that kind of stuff with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of things it can give you an effect that in 2D you can't get. It's an experience that, you know, just in terms of space and stuff like that, and so many other things that you can sort of work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things as a member of the audience is 3D, it sort of immerses you in, like it sort of separates, like you're not watching, you're in it.
Yeah, it's a good format. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for this really nice conversation.
I think I've gone in different, like these little rabbit trails, going different places, didn't lead anywhere, but I must apologize for that. So.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to talk to you, so it's all right.
Okay.
No, anywhere you wanted to go was fine with me. So I was wondering, did you get the MacArthur Genius Award?
I got the MacArthur Award, yeah.
Oh, I thought that would set you for a bit, no?
No, what?
I thought that, like, when you get that because there's money involved, I thought that would, like, you know, sort of help you out significantly.
It did.
Okay, good.
But it went.
But it's gone.
It's all gone. Someone give me another one. Money doesn't last very long when you're in debt and all this kind of stuff like that and have a family, you know.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah.
But it did do well. I mean, I must, you know, be happy because I forget how many years it lasts, but it was long enough for my kids to have insurance and things like that, you know, and, you know, things. I was able to put down on a house, which I was very happy to do, and so that helped. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
and I don't, you know, I must appreciate, I mean, I really am happy for the people who sort of voted for me, well, however they did it, you know, if they made a mistake or whatever it is, but I'm glad, I mean, I'm not giving it back.
Yeah.
They can take the genius part back, because I always have questions about that, but the money, I hate to sound mercenary, but no. No, it did. I'm very appreciative of it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So, I don't know, does the Pulitzer Prize carry any money?
I don't know.
So you need a Pulitzer.
I need every prize they can give. Even if I don't deserve it, I need it, you know.
No, you deserve it. You deserve the genius one for sure. Maybe there could be like an alumni group for the geniuses, and then every so often they sort of give you, you know, a little extra cash to just keep it going.
Well, they do have this club for the MacArthur people,
oh,
but I don't go to that. So because they have physicists and things like that go there, medical people, you know, and you know, chemists and all. All this kind of stuff, and I just say, oh, no, I'm not that kind of a person. <You know?
laughs> But they have other artists that are part of that.
Yeah, but I feel intimidated by those guys. That, you know, I don't know what E squared, whatever it is, and M equals E squared, whatever it was, and that whole thing about energy and all this kind of junk, you know, just, you know, very little.
Well, you are certainly, you know, a master of your craft. So, you know, I mean, there are probably aspects of what you do that are intimidating to them. So.
I hope so. I definitely hope so.
Well, good luck on all of your projects. And
thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this conversation, and look forward to talking to you when you can talk about some of these things, particularly your documentary that's coming along, and hopefully you get the funding and everything else you need so we can see it in the theaters, because it's a really, like, you know, really important story.
It is.
About how we take care of our people.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right, you take care.
Thank you, and you too.
All right, bye-bye. Speaking to director Charles Burnett about his career and about a film that's going to be screening as a part of L.A. Rebellion, creating a new black cinema, which is continuing through October 30th at the Berkeley Art Museum, the UC Berkeley Art Museum and the Pacific Film Archive. And information about all the programs can be gathered by calling 510-642-1124. And for tickets, you can call 510-642-5249, 642-5249, or you can visit bampfa.berkeley.edu, and you can visit the archive. So the film that's going to be screening with Passing Through, directed by Larry Clark, is When It Rains, directed by Charles Burnett, and with screenplay, screenwriter, is also Charles Burnett. And cinematographer and editor is Charles Burnett. And it's produced by Chantel Bernheim with Ayuko Babu, who is the founding director of the Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles. So we have completely run out of time, and I was going to play this wonderful interview with the director of the Museum of the African Diaspora, and I think I'm going to play it anyway, and then I'll play it again. So let me read you the bio for Grace C. Stanislaus. See, prior to assuming the position as Executive Director of the Museum of the African Diaspora, or MOAD, Grace C. Stanislaus was President and CEO of the Vermeer Bearden Foundation in New York. She has held a variety of management and executive leadership positions during nearly 30 years as an arts administrator. Her professional career began as a curator at the Studio Museum in Harlem and developed as executive director of the Bronx Museum of the Arts and of the Museum for African Art in New York. Ms. Stanislaus was formerly senior vice president of the August Wilson Center for African American Culture in Pittsburgh. Trained as an art historian, Ms. Stanislaus has a Master of Arts degree in art history from Columbia University and a Bachelor of Arts degree in art history from Fordham University in the Bronx, where she graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa. And so this really, really, oh my goodness, I cannot express how lovely this exhibit is currently on display at the Museum of the African Diaspora, Desert Jewels, North African Jewelry and Photography from the Xavier Geron Hermes Collection. And again, it's there at MOAD through January 21st, 2013, but you don't want to wait. You want to go and visit often. And the exhibit is also there are companion programs that are going to be happening, lectures and film and, you know, hands-on family activities. You know how they do it at MOAD. So you definitely want to get on by there and visit their website, moadsf.org, and find out what's going on connected to this particular exhibit throughout its stay there for the next few months. So here is Ms. Stanislaus regarding talking about Desert Jewels.
I just love the series that you're doing now around collections and collectors, mm-hmm. and I really like the first one you did, you know, looking at, you know, the Kimbrels out of Southern California, and then collectors that are here in the San Francisco Bay Area that I hadn't been aware of, you know, African people of African descent, you know, finding value in our, you know, sort of the posters and other types of things that other people you normally have more of than we do. So that's really great. And then this one here, I guess your connection with New York, it's like you just be bringing all these premier exhibitions here, because this
is like
West Coast, you know,
right,
like
some influence.
Just putting Northern California on the map.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Yeah. So tell me about about Desert Jewels, the people, because I was reading that. Was talking about how the people, and I don't know how to pronounce the name, not Berber, but the other name.
Yes, Auberzeg, I think.
Okay. And they were supposed to be like the original inhabitants of the region that's highlighted in the exhibition. We're talking
Berbers.
About. And so it's like, oh, I didn't know that, because we're thinking about Egypt and Morocco and Tunisia
and Algeria.
So it's like, and then you think about, you know, sort of the pharaohs and going back to ancient Kemet. And so are you saying in the exhibit, or is it the curator saying that these were the people that they go back to that period as well?
I don't think that's what the show is about, really. You know, what we're saying is that North African culture is very diverse, especially during the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. And it included folks that from sub-Saharan Africa. It included Jews, you know, kind of general Europeans who were attracted by the people and the culture. And, of course, in part by the distinction. I mean, there was a sense of the Oriental, at least this is how they were qualifying it.
Right.
But there were also, you know, slaves from sub-Saharan Africa, you know, and others that had been relocated to North Africa as a part of the kind of rich dynamic of what emerged there.
Okay.
So the photographs in the exhibition, for example, which are from the 19th century, for the most part, you can see the diversity of the people in skin color, in terms of the industries that they were involved with.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting blend of people within a certain region,
mm-hmm.
that were very different cultural backgrounds, different religion, different ethnicities,
mm-hmm.
and that's what made the region so rich. The show is interesting because it really gives us an opportunity to think about North African culture. You know, we know a lot more about West African art and culture and the peoples and the tribes and
mm-hmm.
groups, but not so much about the people that really made up the dynamic energy
mm-hmm.
of North Africa during that time and still
mm-hmm.
To today.
Right.
And so the exhibition, which includes, I guess, over 80 pieces of jewelry and over 24 photographs, or about 24 photographs,
mm-hmm.
really is a combination of telling the story through the photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's interesting about the photographs is, you know, the 10 photographers that's represented, some from the region, other that were foreigners, expats who actually relocated, some lived in the region,
mm-hmm.
others came just to kind of see the exotic, you know, look and to capture that in photography, to take back to, you know, their homeland.
Right.
And this is where this whole notion of the exotic other kind of emerged.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those photographs were staged, you know, to to be interesting.
Uh-huh.
And then others were kind of a natural representation of people in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that included, you know, folks with the, you know, hauling the baskets along the street. It included the women.
Mm-hmm.
There's some scenes of what may be women in a harem, you know, just
mm-hmm.
trying to get a sense of all of the levels and layers of culture
mm-hmm.
that were taking place at the time there.
Right.
So it's the daily lives of
mm-hmm.
these folks.
Right. Yeah, I was looking at, I really like the picture of the water cellar.
Mm-hmm.
He has the bell and he's got this really huge water receptacle
mm-hmm.
that has animal
mm-hmm.
Fur and skin, which
mm-hmm.
I'm sure the water was really cool inside.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that's really interesting. It looks really heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the whole idea of the indigenous types,
mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. Characterizing sort of the Europeans that were taking pictures
mm-hmm.
of Africans,
yes.
and then making them into postcards.
Exactly.
And I'm like, wow, that goes way back. I'm thinking about, you know, the lynchings and
mm.
the postcards
mm.
and, like, you know, the whole other
oh,
that
yes.
you were talking about. It just
mm-hmm.
sort of follows
exactly.
in Western sort of culture. And so the whole idea of sort of representing and the imaging
mm-hmm.
of black people, of African people,
mm-hmm.
of people that are not European,
mm.
Sort of that's just really, really interesting to see that here's one more aspect of that. But then, because you have the artifacts, you've got the jewelry,
mm-hmm.
and you've got the stories about the hand,
mm-hmm.
and the different types of jewels that go into the
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. the ornamentation.
Yes.
So it's sort of kind of, it's like a counter narrative.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is really cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is the collection. I mean, this is a put together, thoughtful collection
mm-hmm.
by Xavier Garand Hermé, and you know, there's a kind of generational thing with Hermé, you know, of course, you know, the Paris-based Hermé empire, quality
mm-hmm.
at all levels, and you know, in terms of jewelry, leather making, fashion,
mm-hmm.
all of the rest of it. But the whole idea of a focused collection,
mm-hmm.
you know, and these objects represent a small portion, it's not the entire collection.
Right.
But, you know, North African photography and jewelry as a combined statement. So in some of the photographs, you do see how the jewelry was worn.
Yes.
And you see that it was, in many cases, very utilitarian objects,
mm-hmm.
you know. Women adorned themselves. But the fibulae, which is the pin, you know, was mm-hmm. to hold the clothing
right,
together.
You keep your skirt up.
Right. So there were some, you know, very practical applications to this.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of it is an aesthetic thing. So you have the cultural, anthropological view
mm-hmm.
of North African peoples and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the aesthetic view of
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the photographs themselves are works of art. The jewels are works of art.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's so interesting about the jewelry in the exhibit is the variety of
mm-hmm.
types.
Right.
You know, you have the headdress, you have the bracelets, you've got the necklaces,
mm-hmm.
you've got these pins.
Mm-hmm.
And then the techniques, the earrings, fabulous, fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the techniques, you know, you have the metalwork, and then you've got different types of stones, so you've got coral and amber and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this amazing variety of types and sizes and weight.
Mm-hmm.
And if some of these were worn, you would be hearing sounds from them. So you have the coins that's attached to it.
Yeah, there's a musicality.
There's a musicality to it. So
yeah.
The woman would be adorned with all of this. And in one or two photographs, you see how men wore the jewelry as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes the show so interesting. Is you could have had a jewelry show, but how interesting would that have been without the photographs,
mm-hmm.
really as a complement. So you see how the people live
mm-hmm.
who are represented. And I think that's the wisdom of this collector.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about what makes, you know, Ormé, there's lots of folks who collect African art. Not all of them care to contextualize,
mm-hmm.
you know, the people at all.
Right.
I mean, it's just here's the thing, here's
mm-hmm.
the mask, here's the.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so this in a way, Ormé was a bit ahead of this time
mm-hmm.
in thinking about, you know, giving, providing us a lens
mm-hmm.
into North African culture at a particular historical period. And, you know, to me, that's what makes the show so incredibly special, is
mm-hmm.
that it does combine these kinds of two elements of three in some ways. Utilitarianism, because these were used objects.
Mm-hmm.
These were not precious things that were put aside.
Right.
And then the beauty of the technical facility,
mm-hmm.
you know, how they were made. You
mm-hmm.
can spend time just looking at how the stones were installed and the filigree work and all of that. And then, you know, this whole notion of objects that are beautiful but artistic,
mm-hmm.
you know, that are utilitarian but artistic.
Mm-hmm.
So there's craftsmanship here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people know how to put together, you know, jewels that not only, that became jewelry,
mm-hmm.
that became adornment,
right.
you know, that women would want to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes it's about having a dowry. You know, the jewelry was about having a dowry.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's about class distinctions.
Mm.
So the more you have, the wealthier, you know, the message might be about who you are in the community.
Uh-huh.
So these objects are just stellar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, the exhibition represents what Moed really does and what we're about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we talk about, we showcase the history, art, and the cultural richness that resulted from the dispersal of Africans throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
But we do that one day in the context of four core themes, and that's origins, migration, well, movement/migration,
mm-hmm.
Adaptation and transformation. So this show is about origins. This show is about looking at the continent
mm-hmm.
and starting there.
Right.
And seeing the kind of richness, the kind of variety, the diversity of people types,
mm-hmm.
And of material objects that came out of the continent.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I admire is that, you know, Ormé and that family saw the value in preserving these things for future generations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, putting together a body of a collection so that we could, you know, really get to understand, because these
mm-hmm.
things could have been, you know, gone. They could
mm-hmm.
have disappeared a long time ago if somebody didn't take responsibility or ownership of
mm-hmm.
making sure that they were preserved.
Right, certainly, certainly. And I want to add a fourth aspect would be
mm-hmm.
spirituality, because I was noticing when I was reading some of the descriptions, it talked about how these particular, some of the ornaments,
mm-hmm.
some of the jewelry protected the wearer from something. And I'm thinking as protection as well as when you think about the hand and some of the way that, like, the pointed clasp was also, it closed the circle, but
exactly.
it also protected the person.
Exactly.
And, and I was also thinking if it's protection, it could also work as a healing.
Oh, absolutely.
So maybe some of the amulets carried medicine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, because I know, you know, the Nkisi do,
mm-hmm.
so,
yes.
you know.
West African art.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was the other element of the show that I guess was a pleasant surprise to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, jewelry, that's all you read, and you think, okay, adornment. But for jewelry to have protective qualities
mm-hmm.
or to have a spiritual element to them, that's the other element, I agree with you, that makes the show so special.
Mm-hmm.
That yes, the women were beautiful and they were adorned with these objects, but mm-hmm. there was another level that we can, you know, take it in terms of understanding their utilitarianism from a spiritual point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wasn't just to clasp your, to keep your wrap up, but there was something about that hand there
yes.
that, you know, was protection, or that fibulae that was protecting against the evil eye. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's levels to the show
mm-hmm.
That is about beautiful objects, utilitarian objects, aesthetic objects,
mm-hmm.
and then spiritual objects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then what makes your show so unique, compared to other places like on the East Coast where it was displayed, is that you bring in Elizabeth Sunday's work
mm-hmm.
and the Tuareg are represented
yes.
in the exhibit,
yes.
and they're nomads. So the migration part of the
yes.
mission is there,
yes.
and then the Tuareg that's current
exactly.
because of what's happening in Mali
mm-hmm.
and the border countries right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Timbuktu,
yes.
right now.
Yes.
What's happening there?
Absolutely.
And what happens and happening in Libya.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like there's a currency, but then, you know, Elizabeth Sunday, you know, sort of looking at these women and,
right.
and they're more subtle jewelry because
yes.
you have to, like, look beneath the veil and underneath.
exactly.
Yeah, and so that's in the salon.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm so glad that we were able to present that show. And it's called Tuareg and Enema, Photographs of Grace. And
mm-hmm.
we kind of capitalized Grace. Photographs of Grace by Elizabeth Sunday. That's
yeah.
that's actually the title of a book, her book, which
oh.
will be in a store. We're
okay.
we're having a store later on.
Okay.
So it's not my name.
Well,
I didn't do that because of me.
But it is your name. But Grace is so wonderful. You know,
oh.
I mean, just the whole idea that there is grace.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
it's
like you might think the abyss is there, but you have grace, so that's the net.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's just, you know,
no,
so...
Grace is... and, you know, for this photographer who's been really engaged in Africa
mm-hmm.
for over 20-plus years, 25 years,
yeah.
lived with the people there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and had privilege and opportunity to kind of see things and get to know some of their cultural practices and
mm-hmm.
beliefs that many of us, you know, would never have privilege. You have to spend time. They
yeah.
have to trust you.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about the show is that for the most part, it's the monumental scale of the work themselves. And then the mystery,
mm-hmm.
you know, the mystery of the veil.
Yeah.
And when a woman is revealed and how amazing that is to be able to see the beauty
mm-hmm.
after the veil is removed. And then there's something interesting about how there's a tradition of how they wrap themselves that passes from generation to generation.
Mm.
So this whole notion... Oops, pardon me. Oh, I know what that is. Okay. So this whole notion of like a performance art in some ways, you know, the women have these indigo wraps
mm.
and then the movement to cover themselves and then the other movement to reveal,
mm.
you know, all of that. And that's what
like a dance, huh?
In some ways. And
mm.
that's what Elizabeth, you know, refers to
mm.
In the work. The anima part of it is the Ife people, EFE, that she also lived and worked
mm.
among.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their belief in animism.
Right.
And they introduced her to this whole kind of concept of a living world.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the objects themselves, you know, in scale and dimension and power
mm-hmm.
are just amazingly compelling. And I think it is a good... Not a contrast, really, but a compliment to the Desert
Definitely.
Jewels
yeah.
exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we are bringing it up to modern times, and we are saying that these folks have continued to have their traditional practices in a rapidly changing world.
Mm-hmm.
But there is still the mystery of the figure of the woman
mm-hmm.
that goes back to, you know, photographs from the 18th and 19th century and early
mm-hmm.
20th.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this whole notion that there are people out there who, while the world is so enticing, the modern world,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's something about tradition and staying grounded in tradition
mm-hmm.
that offers grace.
Right,
you
certainly,
know?
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And then Elizabeth Sunday, the photography, you know, her practice and her, the way, she, you know, her
yes.
unique signature,
yes.
you know, with the stretching.
Right,
they're and
using
the, and
that
the,
mirror.
And the mirror.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so, you know, reflecting, like, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, American, African-American,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to Africa. And
mm-hmm.
so there's that exchange.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, as well.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, it's just, I just love her work. She's
good, yeah.
Uh-huh.
A Bay Area artist. We
uh-huh.
need to, it really follows, Wanda, you know, we started out having this focus with the last show, Choose Paint, Choose Abstraction.
That was so wonderful.
That was nice,
I love
it?
That.
Yeah,
yes.
Celebrating Bay Area abstract artists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing is, MOAD is now positioning itself as the institution that really is interested in celebrating and presenting our local artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why I wanted to introduce Elizabeth Sunday into this
right.
mix.
Yes.
Because she is here, and she has been dealing with the subject that
mm-hmm.
relates to the main show that we have on the third floor.
Right.
But, you know, it continues, the Desert Jewels continues our collector series.
Mm-hmm.
This one continues our focus. Elizabeth's show continues our focus on celebrating and presenting local artists.
Okay.
Yes.
Nice.
From the African diaspora.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My question just sort of flew out of my mind.
It's okay. Well, I'm talking a lot. Maybe I'm answering everything as you go.
You certainly are. You certainly. I was just like taking those. You know how I am. Like
mm-hmm.
when we talked a while back, I just sort of had all these really detailed notes. But I was thinking. I was looking at. Sort of the patterns in the jewelry, the geometric shapes, the coins, the veils, and also Arabic script,
mm-hmm.
Arabic writing, probably from the Quran,
mm-hmm.
and then there were biblical verses probably
mm-hmm.
written in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really interesting. And I didn't even realize that there were palms at Giza.
Mm.
I guess. You know, when I think about the pyramids and there's pictures, photographs of people climbing the pyramids,
mm-hmm.
that's all there is. But I guess there are trees. Have
mm-hmm.
you been to Egypt?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay.
It would be one of those places that I'd love to.
Mm-hmm.
Morocco I'd love to get to.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't mind Tunisia either, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just do North
know.
Africa.
Right.
Myself.
That's a whole other, yes,
mm-hmm.
yes,
right,
part of
yeah.
the world. Love to do it.
And then I noticed with some of the photographs, there was the jewelry, but then there was also the scarification.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like more, you know, beautiful etchings
mm-hmm.
in the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Like particularly I'm thinking about the man
yes.
who had the head wrap on, and then
mm-hmm.
he had the jewelry in there.
Yes.
It's really,
yes.
really lovely.
Well, you know, some of these photographs, at least some of the photographers of the period, were looking at African physiognomy.
Mm.
And were really, and that photograph that you referred to with the clearly African man in profile
mm-hmm.
is one that fits into a kind of pattern of looking at, it's kind of physiometrics, you know,
mm-hmm.
looking at what makes, in some ways, what makes whites superior to blacks
mm-hmm.
physiognomically.
Yeah.
And so there was a whole thing at one time to focus on the superiority of whites as opposed to blacks that you know, in terms of the physical attributes
mm-hmm.
of the face, the mouth, the nose, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that particular photograph actually is referred to in the catalog as fitting into that frame
mm-hmm.
where it was taken to represent the difference in physiognomy
mm-hmm.
between Caucasians and whites and to support
mm-hmm.
the whole notion of, you know,
superiority.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and that was happening though. There was a
yeah.
whole pseudoscientific effort
sure
to make
mm-hmm.
us, you know, to make Africans, you know, be seen in the world as less
mm-hmm.
than others.
Right.
Know? So
yeah.
That you know, there's one or two, and particularly that one that you referred to
mm-hmm.
in the show that really
right.
references that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter.
But it backfires.
Because he's beautiful.
Yes.
He's fabulous.
He really
and
is.
And the scarification. And all of that comes with him, the
mm-hmm.
elegance,
mm-hmm.
the pride,
yeah.
you know, that
mm-hmm.
comes through in that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorite photographs
mm-hmm.
in the show, actually.
Yeah, and then there's the woman and the child
mm-hmm.
who doesn't have any jewelry on. And
mm-hmm.
and they wear these really interesting dresses that look, they sort of remind me a little bit of the European dresses with the bodice
mm-hmm.
and the puffiness.
Mm-hmm. That's a typical Jewish dress.
Oh.
Of the period.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a ornamented
uh-huh.
full
mm-hmm.
Skirt.
Yeah.
Has the wrap in the middle,
mm-hmm.
bodice in the middle,
yeah.
and a top with a sleeve that's removable.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a classic Jewish dress of
yeah.
women of a certain, I don't know, age,
okay.
maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know, years
mm-hmm.
that is in the show. And
yeah.
so, mm-hmm.
But then there's the one of the black woman
not the Jewish woman, but the African woman that I guess would be more of a tight kind of African woman, and she's got the little baby on her hip.
Oh, okay.
And the dress is solid color. And she's on that wall, the back wall. And I don't know, it's probably in here. But I just, it was an interesting contrast because she's next to, that photograph is next to the one where got the girl sitting having tea, and one of them didn't close her top, or the person, the photographer should have told her to cover her.
But that was, there are photographs that were taken during that period that were actually staged. You see, there was a window that's in the back of them that makes the scene look as though it's in a harem.
That's the
harem one? Yes, that's the harem one. And so I know exactly the one that you're talking about, where a portion of, you know, her is revealed. She didn't cover herself.
Right.
But in, you have to be mindful that some of these photographs were actual people in their situations, and others were kind of framed up a little bit to give a flavor, maybe a little bit more exotic. But that one was, you know, intended to kind of give the sense of a harem. So
probably sold really well on the postcards.
I'm sure.
Because they are really beautiful young women.
Oh, they are.
they are really beautiful.
And whatever the intention of the photographers were, you know, during that period, especially the Europeans, you know, the people come through in their honesty and, you know, the sincerity of their life. And, you know, yes, you have these folks who are coming in like voyeurs, you know, to look and to peek and all of that. But these photographs are so amazing, just as objects of art, I mean, on their own. And then the jewels, they're incomparable. I mean, just incomparable, you know. So I'm just really delighted that we're able to present a show of this caliber, you know, at the museum, that gives us such an opportunity to kind of delve into the educational, you know, to have a strong core educational aspect, you know, that allows us to really kind of explore and talk further about North African culture in a serious, meaningful way. It's a great exhibit.
Yeah, I think so too. It's, the outfit is like this one, but this isn't the one I'm talking about. Yeah, I just wanted to, I remember now what I wanted to say is that this, you know, looking at, you know, these desert jewels, I mean, there are men, but this is such a positive statement on women in Africa. I mean, because they're, I mean, it's just, they're so beautiful. And it's like, wow, these sisters, like, look at that earring. How did she wear that? Boy, look at the, what do you call the jewelry that you close things with? Like you, I'm trying to think, you like could wear it around your waist and it would close, keep your skirt up. Fibula. It's like, and these just regular folk. I mean, they're like, wow. I mean, it doesn't just, it doesn't look like silver. It is silver. And it's gold and amber and coral and turquoise. And I mean, I saw one with glass, but all that silver was hanging off the glass. Like,
wow. No, this is a, you know, this is a major exhibit, and it comes with all of the, what you would define as, you know, important works, valuable works.
Really lovely, and I'm thinking, wow, I want to make something. I was thinking, okay, let me, it's in the book, so I'm going to, like, go find.